Why are they doing this? They said when you got here, the whole thing started. I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil. Evil!
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Monsters, John. Monsters from the It.
Swallow this.
The power of Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you!
Have you ever heard Candyman?
You moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you?
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
You don't know what that is.
This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation.
Messenger of God, you do need to stay here.
God is dead!
He is dead!
Satan lives!
Oh, it's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The animals are contagious! What fun! Stop! You have no idea!
You're not afraid of the dark, are you?
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Secretary, the missiles are flying.
You'll see me in hell, Mr. Thorne. There will be a shower of your senses.
I can't lie to you about your choices, but you have my sympathies.
This little procedure is called making a head of a mistake.
I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
There is no one watching out for us, Meryl. We are all on our own.
And there's no more room in hell for the dead who walk here.
The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Something in the mill! Shut the door, Baker! You gotta tell them! Silent Breed is people!
You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over!
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, man?
It's going well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Ninu. Sorry, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
Awesome. I'll tell you why in a minute. Keep going.
What's Nino? I don't get that.
Nino,
somebody didn't do their homework.
Did you watch our movie tonight?
Yeah, but I still don't get the Nino.
It's all right, the rabbit.
It's the
oh
bunny.
Yeah, that's right. All right, we'll discuss. Yes, yes. All right, and in the state of Massachusetts.
Hey, everyone, it's Dave.
Dave, how's it going, man?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. And a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
I'm wishing I was still in Disney World, but other than that, I'm really good.
But that's every day for you, isn't it?
Yeah, but this trip was especially awesome, so it was good.
I actually have a question about that, Christy. You were in Disney World for your anniversary, right?
Yes.
So
our anniversary.
Do you make Nathan wear Mickey Mouse ears?
Yes.
Nathan, okay. All right.
Nate and buttons and the whole thing. But we basically what happened was it was an anniversary gift for our third anniversary, and the only time we could go was in May. So I actually bought us the trip as his anniversary gift.
Very good.
If that makes sense. So, yeah. So technically we were there for anniversary, and everybody gave us free booze everywhere we went. So
sweet. That worked.
Yeah, we decided we're going to have an anniversary every time we go now.
Scammer.
All right, very good. Now, a couple of house cleaning things. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan. What do the folks know about that?
It is a general interest podcast called the Ascancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Stitcher, the mobile app, or on the iTunes Store.
Very good. And Mike, you do a genre blog.
Yes, that's Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. If you go check that out now, or being the internet 20 years from now, you'll find my most recent post about the Scarecon weekend that we just had in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Excellent. Very well. And let's see. I have a couple questions for you on that after we get finished the round table here. But Eric, you do another podcast with a couple of folks. Why don't the folks know about that?
Sorry. I'm flashing back to a Facebook conversation. Yes, it is a spinoff podcast of this show. It is a Game of Thrones podcast that we call You Know Nothing, Jon Snow. It is available in its own feed as a podcast. It's also available in the feed for this podcast. But we don't have the resources to get it dedicate to its own set of communications. So please use the Dark Discussion page as well as the darkdiscussions@AOL.com email address for communication purposes for the You Know Nothing, Jon Snow podcast.
Excellent. Very well. And Christy, what do you do?
I am a writer of short dark fiction, and you can find out more about
me. Now you're just
me.
Doing it on purpose.
I know. I actually have to think, though, to make sure I say it right, because you guys have corrupted me. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Excellent. And Abe, you do a genre book.
Yep, it's called The Real Movie Reviewer. You can find it by going to your basic search engine and typing it in. Or easier way to get into it is to go to Dark's main page and look on the right-hand side. Through there, you can find a link that will allow you to access my blog, along with everyone else's as well.
Excellent. Very good. And Christy, I know you have some exciting news. You and myself were accepted into an anthology. Why don't you explain what that is? I know you mentioned the story a couple of weeks ago to folks, but you couldn't announce anything else, you know, if it would make it into the anthology and who was doing it and all that.
Right. MJ Preston has a press called Skinwalker Press, and his first short story collection that he put out was called Dark Passages. This second one that Phil and I have stories in is called Dark Passages 2, and the focus for each of the stories is that it needs to be set on a highway or have something to do with a highway. And this was a spinoff, as what little I know about it, was a spinoff of a project that he's been meaning to do for a while, because a couple of years ago he had asked if I would be interested in participating in something like this. And then I think whatever he needed to gel just finally gelled. I know he had some other projects on his plate. So that is going to be out. I'm not sure if it's this summer or this fall, but I have a story in it called Muhina. And Phil has a story in it. Phil, I can't remember the name of your story.
It's called Shrouds of Snow.
Yes, so, Shrouds of Snow.
You know nothing, Shrouds of Snow.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to that coming out soon, and we will let you listeners know when it is available. And I'm sure we'll be putting up links on the Dark Discussions pages when it's out.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Christy, was the original, was that a anthology? Was it just his short stories, or was it?
I think it was just his short stories, yes. I think.
Okay. Like, and I know, Mike, you got a copy of that, don't you?
Of which one?
MJ Preston's Dark Passages, Volume 1?
Yes, I do. I purchase it off of Amazon, where all books are sold by law.
Very good. Very good.
Under penalty of death.
Excellent. So folks can go check that out, the first Dark Passages anthology, if they want to support a pretty good author that has actually been on the show a number of times. And that's actually how
an author who has donated to the Dark Discussions podcast a copy of all of his books to be given away at Scares the Care.
Yep, excellent. And actually, that's what I think Great Old Ones Publishing is going to do, Mike. I think they're just going to mail you a bunch of books, and you can just pack them in with MJ Preston's books.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll send you some too, Mike, if you want, that you can give away with the discs or whatever.
Sure, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, I just have to put it on my list of things to do.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment, the skiers I care. But, Mike, you just mentioned that we got back from a convention in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I haven't talked to you about it, but you were on a panel on Sunday. How was that?
Well, I believe I've related this story before, but if I haven't, I'm going to say it again.
You probably did on You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, but not everybody listens to that podcast. This will be the first time it's mentioned on Dark Discussions since we returned.
Well, no, I'm saying that's an earlier, probably going way back for longtime listeners, when I first went to Horror Realm. I attended they had a panel on how to do a horror podcast or something about how to make a good horror podcast. And since we had just started the podcast that summer, and it was, I think, September, I went to attend it. And it was me in the audience and four podcasters sitting up at the front of the room, and that was it. There was nobody else. It was my own personal seminar of four podcasters. And by the following year, I think all four of them had stopped podcasting. So anyway, this year we go to ScareCon, the first time we're invited as guests, or at least I've been invited as a guest to a convention. And we both get asked to serve on a panel. You got to do one on Friday. I got to do one on Sunday. And it was once again a panel about how to have an effective horror podcast. And this time the table was turned, as I was one of four panelists sitting up on the stage, and there was only one person in the audience. The difference this time is that the person sitting in the audience was not, in fact, interested in having a podcast. They were just there because their boyfriend was on the panel. And the funny thing is, we ended up basically still doing the panel anyway. I don't know why, because nobody was recording it. And actually, the panel before us was on 80s horror. That was packed. So they all, like, ran out of the room to avoid having to listen to the podcasting panel.
And how did you enjoy it, Mike? Was it fun for you?
Oh, I had a lot of fun. I spoke with J.V. Johnson, who's the guy who invited us there. I told him how much we enjoyed it. I offered some suggestions about maybe what to do for the panel, because I think having a podcasting panel, the people who are interested in podcasting are there podcasting. And that maybe to do something like, you know, having us debate debate found footage films or remakes or discussing the, you know, recent movies or something like that. Something that people who are not podcast people are interested in hearing. But I really enjoyed it. Christy, you made, what was it, 32? 36? 3 million? How many?
Actually, I think I got, like, was it 34 discs? Yeah, because I was short, like a jerk. I totally didn't order
short and
discs.
Dark and fictitious.
Yes, short, dark, and stupid. Yeah. But yeah, so anyway, go on.
Yeah, so anyway, so we passed all of those out. So some, if we get some of those as listeners, that'd be great. We met our first actual listener, in Anthony Thurber. Admittedly, they are a very recent listener. They're no long time, Michelle Barkley listener, but he did hear us in their interview with J.V. Johnson to promote the convention, and he said he liked what he heard, and he actually bought one of Travis Heckel's the zombie T-shirt, Dark Discussions T-shirt, and so we're appreciative of him for that, and hope that he continues to listen. But yeah, the convention was a blast. The main thing is I got to meet Adrian Barbeau.
Yep, very good.
I think made Vinegar Syndrome an official dependent.
That's true. That's true. I came home with about 13 or 14 DVD or Blu-rays from Vinegar Syndrome. That is correct. Yes.
So, and I know we have gotten a few extra people, I think, on the website now. On the not the website. Excuse me, the Facebook page.
Yep.
So yep. We it's quite possible we are starting to get some people from this, and that would be terrific. The whole point of this is we were there, and I was joking with a number of the vendors, is they have a chance to recoup their investment. We're there pretty much at a loss. You know, you paid for like your T-shirts. I paid for the buttons that we're giving away. Christy paid for the discs. And while we didn't have to pay for our table or tickets to get in, which was very nice and generous of the convention to do that for us. We still had to pay for the hotel rooms, transportation, and all that other stuff that we're giving away. So we had no chance at all of recouping a profit from this convention. It was there just to meet the listeners and to play up the podcast and see if we could recruit more people to the cause.
Yes, that's right. And the convention was a good time. Met a lot of folks. Mike got a bunch of really good autographs, including the two leads from Frankenhooker, as well as you mentioned, Adrian Barbeau, PJ Souls, among others. And I did like that idea, Mike. Maybe next year, if we're invited back, and their podcast lectures or whatever you want to call them, panels, something could be said like a horror podcast review is debate found footage films or something like that. And that would be kind of I think would attract more people, because if it's how to make a podcast, we would probably have only a handful of folks versus talking horror. And I think that would have brought in more people to the panels, I think, at least the podcast panels.
And we did meet a lot of nice people there, and there were other podcasts such as The Dorkening, which is a YouTube video podcast, and the Deadite podcast. There was something about the TV Universe. I can't remember what that was called.
Yeah. I unfortunately don't have the list in front of me.
But yeah, so there were a lot of people. If you go to ScareCon and you look up who the podcasters were there, the Trick or Treat Radio was a big one there. You might want to give them all a listen, just to, again, help support ScareCon, help support those podcasts, and help them continue to do this in the future, just for the sole purpose of helping to support Dark Discussions. Weirdly enough, just don't start listening to them by getting rid of us.
That's right. Absolutely. All right. Now, let's see. Let's get into some stuff. Let's get this out of the way first, Mike. What are the talk about the Scare That Care stuff so we can let folks know about that?
Right. Well, Scares That Care is a 501c3 charitable organization that donates money to families in need, and this is the third year that they are having a convention as a fundraiser down in Williamsburg, Virginia. In this case, it's going to be on July 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. And we will be down there with a booth, once again, to help meet listeners and promote the podcast. But we'll also be doing some things to raise some money for Joe Ripple, who is the founder and the organization. And you please go to their website, go to their Facebook page. It is very much on the up and up. Some of the people they're going to be helping might be there, which would be nice. Usually they tend to shy away from the spotlight. We'll be giving some things, well, not giving some things, we'll be raffling some things off, including some books, I believe, a poster that's being donated by Michelle Barkley that hopefully we'll talk more about once that arrives, and perhaps some other things, depending on what's going on. And you and I and Patrick Lacey and Elizabeth Catherine Gray from the Archivist Bet on Sexy Witches podcast will be doing a panel on the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein, where we'll also be giving some things away.
Yep, that's right. And also, a listener, Holly Masiak, plans to give away some of her artwork. I'm supposed to coordinate with her, and more details will come when after I discuss things with her. And that's about it. As I queue up an email, Mike, why don't you let folks know about the T-shirts?
Somebody else has to start pulling the load here, guys. Okay, there's T-shirts we're giving away. No, I'm sorry. We are not giving away. We're doing a fundraiser through Booster.com by selling T-shirts. There are two designs. There's a very classic horror design, which is a skull with a microphone that says Dark Discussions Podcast on a black T-shirt. And then there is a white T-shirt for those of you who want to support Phil in his pathetic attempt to call little dogs real animals, that says little dogs love Dark Discussions.
Hey, I bought that one.
Yeah, you bought that one. In fact, I think I believe it's, we've sold seven. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We've sold 7 of the little dog shirts, and I think
another one though for my cousin. So it's going to be 8 very soon.
Okay, and 8 of the skull shirts. And admittedly, 2 of each of those were for me, but 1 for me, 1 for my wife, another 1 for me, and then 1 for someone supporting our, who's made a donation to the Frankenstein panel. So I'm giving her a t-shirt because she refused to accept any money. And the point of this is basically to help cover some of the costs that go with the conventions and the podcasting, all the promotional stuff. We are not making getting rich off of this. These are only going to be available until June 30th. So please act quickly if you want to get it. We're not saying we'll never, ever sell any t-shirts again. But right now, this is a trial balloon. We're seeing how this goes. And this website is only a limited time thing. We'd have to switch to something else if we want something ongoing. And you can donate to the podcast through booster.com if you'd like, without buying a t-shirt. That's fine too. But if you're going to give us some money, why not get yourself a shirt, help promote the podcast that way, make it a little bit more visible, and people go, hey, what's with the little dog barking into the microphone? little dog design, I do want to point out, coming from blanking on his name, an artist.
Maurice,
an artist on DeviantArt. That
does
was
anybody call him
Chris.
The Space Cowboy?
Yes, the artist is has the tag of Hero Jax on DeviantArt, and it was found by listener Chris Genero, and I want to thank them both. It's Maurice Miller. There it is. So I do want to thank both of them for helping put that together and inspiring the design.
Excellent. All right. Sounds good. So let's go read this email, which is somewhat related to that. And so here we go. It's from a listener named Michelle Barkley. And this is what she has to say. She goes, so what makes me a happy Dark Discussions podcast listener? Well, being able to donate whenever I damn well want. I love it. I am going to need a new way to donate once that booster page for the t-shirts is no longer available. Just saying. I've actually been able to keep up on the episodes now since I am back to being alone on my shift. She's a baker, by the way. Between the regular Dark Discussions podcast shows and being able to listen to the You Know Nothing Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast episodes, I am in heaven. I love that you gents released the episode so quickly. The material is still fresh in my mind, and I don't have to go back for a rewatch before I listen. What more can I say about the best damn podcast there is? Thank you guys and Christy for always making my work nights fly by. I love the length of the shows. When I click on and see I have a podcast that is around 2 hours in length, I know it's going to be a great night. Thank you all for taking the time out of your lives to watch these movies and shows and to take the time to record your thoughts on them. I appreciate it more than you'll ever know, and I know I am not the only one out there who feels that way. Yay for a donate button. Michelle Barker. So,
Thank you, Michelle. We appreciate the kind words and the donations.
She is like the most awesome fan ever. She gets like number one fan button, totally.
Amen.
So we'll put up a PayPal thing sooner or later, hopefully by the end of
the show. You know we're recording, right, Phil?
Yeah, I keep on saying that.
All right.
And I never do, but I'll get one up. It's not that hard. It's just... It'll take less than an hour, so I'll figure it out.
It's an hour, 5 years, something like that. But I think it's fair to say that, and this is something we were talking about behind the scenes at the convention. It is really kind of humbling knowing that there's people out there that listen to you week in, week out, that are devoted to you. You can't really imagine why, but at the same time. You know, we've all been on the opposite side of the fandom. You know, I found out if you want to get me tongue-tied, put me in front of Adrian Barbeau, and that'll seem to do it. You don't always know what impact you're having on people, and it's, believe me, Michelle, just the fact that you're out there listening helps us get through, the week, or at least me. I don't know about Eric or Abe, but we really do appreciate everything you and all the other fans. You're just our most prominent and vocal, and I can tell you looking at the booster.com donations that there are people who don't regularly write emails, who do not regularly post on the Facebook page, and we get it. Not everybody does that. I'm not criticizing those people, but there are people out there that we didn't even know existed. So we know now we have more than five listeners. We have at least six or seven, and that's terrific. And, you know, we do want to thank them. In fact, might as well mention, again, we have our usual suspects have donated. Michelle Barkley, you know, we've mentioned Kevin Letts, Christy Peterson-Schoonover has donated. Mike Darwin has donated. But also Philip Butler, Christopher Percha has donated. Chris Genro has donated. And he's, let's see, who I mentioned before. And more recently, Julie Vernig and Matthew Silva. You know, they've all donated, and they're not names I'm used to seeing. And so it's glad to see them know that they're out there, know that we're somehow enriching their lives enough that they're willing to buy a T-shirt.
Hey, yep. I only donate because I got to give you something for putting up with my shit.
Yeah, well. And again, if you haven't heard, because when I first started announcing the T-shirts, that they were only going to be sold if they hit a certain amount. We passed that threshold, so they're certainly going to be produced and sent out. So you should be getting them in a little over a month.
Yep, exactly. And if anybody wants to take a selfie with the pictures and put them up on the Facebook page, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook page, or email darkdiscussions@aol.com, we'll share those pictures with folks to show your support to our podcast. I did want to mention one thing to Abe, who's not on the Facebook any longer. He's temporarily taking a break. He'll probably one day come back, but about a year now he's dropped off. Abe, someone on the Facebook group wanted to thank you personally. A listener named Pamela Dunleavy wrote on the Facebook page that she wanted to thank Abe for pointing out her in the direction of an anime entitled Death Note, and she's saying she's enjoying it tremendously, and she wanted to thank you personally, though she knows you cannot see the thank you because you're not on Facebook.
Well, you're very welcome. Yeah, you know, enjoy it. I mean, it's a great series, and, you know, I mean, I wish there was more out there. I like it. Another one you might want to check out, if you can find it, is Monster by Noaki Urasawa. That's a cool psychological crime thriller with a bit of horror in it. They're re-releasing the manga right now, but the anime, you might have to try and find streaming. But that's another one I recommend you check out once you finish with Death Note.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about Monster as well, Abe. So though I have not seen it, I can verify that it has gotten excellent reviews. So that's that. And I believe Pam Dunleavy is Mike Dunleavy's wife, as a matter of fact.
There's a rumor to that effect. I think she denies it, but.
And Mike, have you been watching the anime by any chance?
No, I have not.
Okay, very well.
I probably spent more time sitting with the guys from the Dorkening this last weekend than I have with Pam for the last 2 months.
Well,
it's just a very rough time of year for the two of us.
I understand. And I assume that's on Netflix, but I'm just guessing. I know Netflix has a hell of a lot of good animes available for streaming.
Death Note is available on Netflix, actually.
Very good. All right, so let's do just a quick round of what we've been watching and news. We'll wrap them all together. So when you get to each person, you can give up any news or films that you've seen, books, video games, whatever, that you think are interesting for the listeners. And let's start with you, Eric.
I haven't really had time to watch. Wow. Watch much over the last week. the only thing I have to mention isn't really news, but I just discovered today that I actually know somebody who was involved peripherally with the production of The Conjuring 2. She works in the art department, and she made the Ouija boards, the props for the movie. So that's kind of cool that I know the person that did that. So I'm going to go see that movie tomorrow and look for her Ouija board in the movie.
And those reviews are pretty good. Also, one of our listeners, Madison from Australia, she has seen the film in a sneak peek a couple of weeks ago, and she said it was phenomenally excellent. And sure enough, Rotten Tomatoes, it's getting a good fresh tomato on the tomato meter. So it looks like it's a winner. Finally, a Hollywood horror film this year that looks like is going to get respect from both critics and, I guess, viewers or audience members alike. So that's pretty exciting, I guess. Chrissy, what about yourself?
I've actually done absolutely nothing other than the movie we were supposed to watch tonight. So,
because you were Disney, you
I was in
whore
Disney,
you.
Man. Well, I saw every princess, and I was in the stunt show. I was a pretty busy girl. So,
now Eric, folks who are curious about the girl or the woman that did the Ouija boards, what's her name? Because I know she has an IMDb page.
Yeah, her name is Jamie Clank. That Jamie is spelled J-A-M-I-E and Clank is K-L-E-N-K, and she does have an IMDb page. And you Hollywood folk out there who need a good person for your art department, look her up.
Yep, and to be honest, she looks like she could be a stunt double for Natalie Dormer, because she kind of looks like her, actually, based on my viewing of her pictures.
I don't know if there's any similarity there other than the fact that they're both beautiful.
Yeah, all right, well, the same color eyes, maybe, too. That's about it.
Phil sees Natalie Dormer behind every tree.
Right. But yeah, so but if you happen to be a stalker out there, you're looking for your next target, here's a possibility.
Oh, stop.
That's
not nice.
Terrible, Mike. Of course, Mike would have ruined the whole night for everybody. Jesus.
I don't know, that was good.
Just make sure to tell her that Eric sent you.
Oh, for Christ.
You know what? Right. I would feel kind of bad about it if it weren't all public information anyway, so.
Yeah. for me, I've seen a couple of films in the past week or two. First film I wanted to bring up is the movie Pigs, P-I-G-S. It's one of the films I picked up at the Vinegar Syndrome booth at Scarecon. It's a new release from about a month and a half ago. It's a double disc Blu-ray and DVD combo. It's the first time it's come out on media with the original cut. It's directed by a guy named Mark Lawrence. Everybody would probably know him if they just look him up on IMDb. He's a big-time character actor that has passed away now, but was big in the 50s and so forth. I think the film is really good. Abe, this is your type of film for sure. I would recommend checking it out. I don't know where you can see it, except maybe through the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray in the correct format. So folks who want to check that out, it's an interesting thing about two mentally disturbed people that come together out at this pig farm and pig farm/diner. And
wait, what? Say that again.
Pig farm/diner?
Well, lots of bacon. Free bacon, right?
Well, the owner of the pig farm also owns a diner. And so what happens is this girl comes into town, gets a job at his diner, and the two of them have some issues. And it's hard to explain without ruining it, so I won't. But folks who want to just check out IMDb can probably get the or probably just better to go to vinegarsyndrome.com and get the blurb of the film there. But if you like a lot of films that Abe likes, or even me for that matter, and I think Mike would like the film a lot too, to be honest, it's definitely a film worth checking out.
Was this by any chance based on a true story?
It was not, no.
Okay, because we just finished doing reports on serial killers in my forensics class, and one of them was about Robert Picton, who killed women and fed them to pigs.
Oh, interesting. No, this wasn't based on that. Yeah.
Was Mike, I just want to interrupt for a second. Maybe that was what Motel Hell was based on?
I think he's more recent than that.
Really?
I'm trying to remember if he was...
Motel Hell was the one where the guy feeds the women to the pigs, right? Or am I totally confused?
No,
Motel Hell is where he plants them in a garden.
And then he feeds them he makes sausages out of them, and he feeds them to people.
Right.
I'm getting confused.
Yeah. And then I saw Lucio Fulci's film, The Black Cat. You can buy it now through Arrow Blu-ray. as a standalone disc, but I bought it in the limited edition 2-disc set that came with Sergio Mate's Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. And it comes with a really good informational booklet in this box set by Arrow Blu-ray. And both films are based off of Edgar Allan Poe's The Black Cat. And excellent films. I saw the Sergio Martino's earlier, but last night I watched The Black Cat by Lucio Fulci, and it was very good. So I think, Mike, you would like both of these films for sure, and probably you too, Chrissy.
I think I've seen them, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
if it's Poe and it's Black Cat, and I'm recognizing these names, were they ever on Laserdisc?
Yeah, ooh, that's a good question.
I've definitely seen them because my housemate has all that. Anything Black Cat, he's got it on Laserdisc.
Yeah, I think they were, actually. I think they were. So you may have seen them. We're checking them out for folks who
Yes, I just looked it up online. Yes, I have. Yes, my housemate has these. I've seen them.
Okay.
Both of them. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So definitely worth checking out there. Horror/Giallo type films, basically more horror than Giallo, but directors are probably more well known for Giallo films. Seen a few other films, but I'll talk about them another time. So, hey, Bob, let's go with you.
Aside from today's topic, I didn't get a chance to see a whole lot. I just recently came back from seeing Captain America: Civil War. Overall, it's a pretty good superhero film. I don't know if I would say it's up to par with some of the earlier entries. It's kind of low on the wit level. I just remember with the other past superhero films, there was a lot more humor that actually got a reaction from me. This one was kind of, I guess you played more of the action and the drama than the previous ones. It's good, enjoyable, but I feel like it's the kind of film you need to see most of the previous entries to kind of get an idea of who's who and past events. It's pretty good. Overall, it's a fun. I'm not sure. I wouldn't say it's the best, but wasn't bad. Aside from that, that's all that's on my end.
All right, very good. Sounds good. Mike, what about yourself?
I forgot to mention one thing last week, which is that I saw Victor Frankenstein, which is the the
John McAvoy one, right?
Yes, that came out with Daniel Radcliffe. That came out last November. I really kind of found it flat. There were some of the things in performances I liked, but I think it just didn't really give a good enough reason to exist to bother watching it. If you have any curiosity in it, you may want to check it out when it comes onto Netflix, if it ever makes, or some other free streaming service. But I wasn't all that thrilled with it. Otherwise,
Mike,
I've been.
Did you rent it or buy it?
I bought it on sale through the Vudu streaming service, so I didn't pay a lot for it.
Yep.
It was okay. It wasn't horrible, but it wasn't particularly good either. Other than that, I've mostly still been playing Dragon Age Inquisition on what free time I've had, but it's been really busy. The only other thing I did want to mention is I've been catching up on some because I was an idiot and went way too long without a visit to the dentist. So I've been catching up on dental work recently, and the dentist knows my affection for horror films, especially since today I was wearing an Alien T-shirt.
The Marathon Man.
And yeah, no, not Marathon Man. That would have been a nice one, but no. Instead, he asked me if I liked Prometheus. And, you know, to which I said not particularly, or, you know, as best as you can with somebody's hand in your mouth. And then as he's drilling, he's proceeding to rant and rave about how awful Prometheus was, which is exactly what you want while a dentist is drilling your mouth.
Well, at least he was a smart dentist, right? I mean, he was on the right side.
Where was Lance Hendrickson when we needed him? Run left, run right. Just what are you doing? You know, it's like, oh god. It was a little scary there. You know, he was getting a little bit too into it. Maybe he's got a podcast in it himself. But otherwise, and tomorrow. I want to go see Conjuring 2, but Pam's got a concert Saturday, and I've got to go to the prom on Friday. Speaking of which, does anyone know where I can find a bucket of pig's blood at the last minute?
So you're being a chaperone at the prom or something?
Yeah, I am.
I understand.
I could go down my block here to Stu Leonard's, the farmer's market. I'm sure they have some.
Yeah, but yeah, I need it for tomorrow night. I don't think it's going to happen.
I could FedEx it.
Oh, there you go. All right.
All right. Very good. All right. So if that's it, anyone have any further things they forgot, or are we all set? Anyone?
We're good.
Yeah, I knew Eric was going to say that. So, Eric, what are you? Well, there's another terror tantrum. I'm not sure of the subject, so let's hear that. That's by Patrick Lacey. Throw that in right now, and let's come back after he's done.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. My name is Patrick Lacey. I'm a horror author and longtime listener to Dark Discussions. If you're new to the podcast, this is a segment where I take a look at a slightly lesser known or obscure horror film and give a hopefully unbiased review as I am seeing it for the first time. That's technically not true this week. This film is Lord of Illusions, directed by Clive Barker. I saw this film when it first came out when I was a kid, except about halfway through my parents shut it off and said it was too intense, which is funny because they didn't really put a whole lot of restraints on what I watched as a kid, and so I always wondered if there was something like really, really disturbing in this movie. And while there is, you know, certainly a lot of gore and torture things, and we'll get into that later in the review, it's funny because I still don't know to this day why they chose this one at random, because I don't think it's that graphic compared to the other things I watched. I think they probably just didn't like it. But like I said, this is Lord of Illusions, released through Scream Factory. If you haven't heard of Scream Factory, go hear of them. They are one of the better companies putting out these sort of lesser-known horror movies, though they do have some more popular ones. They do some Craven films, some John Carpenter films, etc., and they also do some Clive Barker films. They did Nightbreed last year. What was special about Nightbreed, if you're not familiar, there was a huge studio battle where they made Clive Barker cut out about like an hour of footage, which was thought to be lost, and then they added it in and then released it from Scream Factory. And then this is similar with Lord of Illusions. As the story goes, it should be noted this is the last and final film that Clive Barker directed. And supposedly the studio made him take out a lot of the gory parts, and he agreed with the thought that when it was released on home video, it would be released as a director's edition that would have all the stuff that they took out, which didn't happen. And I think because of that experience, Clive just decided he did not want to deal with Hollywood anymore. I'm happy to report this version of the film has both the theatrical cut and director's cut, which is what the latter is what I watched. Like I said, there is a lot of gore. I don't think it's enough to really warrant, you know, anything more than an R rating. So take that, mom and dad, because it's not that bad in terms of gore. But I'm just going to read a quick synopsis and we'll get into the review. It says, Harry D'Amore is a private detective visiting Los Angeles on a routine investigation. He gets more than he bargains for when he encounters Philip Swan, a performer whose amazing illusions captivate the world. But are they really illusions? Harry isn't so sure as he is thrust into a nightmare of murder, deception, and terrifying assaults from the dark beyond. So this film stars Scott Bakula, which you might remember from Quantum Leap, and I believe he was on a bunch of television shows in the 90s. And then also, is it Femke Jensen? I can never say her name correct, but you probably know her from X-Men and more recently Hemlock Grove. She's been in tons of things. Great performances from these actors all throughout, which is one of the main, I guess you could say, selling points for this, because I think if they had other actors who didn't really sell it as well, I don't think the concept alone would have made it a great film. There are really interesting things, but I think the majority of the good things about this film are from the performances. So that's the first positive right off the bat. This movie kind of has a bad reputation. I've heard a lot of people say they don't like it. I know it underperformed when it first came out. I disagree. It's interesting. It's hard to follow. There's a lot going on, and there's sort of these long conversations about almost like metaphysical things that have to do with magicians. So it is a little bit hard to follow along. It's not really the kind of movie that you can just like have your phone out and take a peek every once in a while at the screen. You really do have to shut out the rest of the world and just watch it, and watch it closely. It has a great noir feel. A lot of sort of like I said, dialogue and long conversations, but a lot of quick quips from Scott Bakula, that make this film kind of stand out from the other two films that Clive Barker directed. I don't know, perhaps, if the mixture of noir and horror just wasn't more popular at this time. This was released in the 90s. And should be noted, this is the first movie from the 90s that I've reviewed on Terror Tantrums. I just realized that. But that aside, you know, I really like the noir feel. If you like things like The Postman Always Rings Twice, things like that, you'll really, really like this, especially if you like the old noir films from the 50s and 60s. And I think this, you know, noir is kind of making a comeback in recent years, and I can't tell for sure, but I think this probably had something to do with it. I kind of get a True Detective vibe from this, from season one. Season two, if you haven't seen it, is god-awful. But if you liked season one of True Detective, and you like horror things, presumably you do because you're here, I would definitely give this a chance because it's a really interesting film and an odd one for Barker to go out on because it's definitely the – I would say it's the most different of his three films, but also the most Barker-ish, if that makes sense. There's definitely like a tone of like sexuality and homoeroticism that runs throughout all his work, but I think it's definitely most prevalent here. And I think he was really trying something different, and that may be why it underperformed. But honestly, a lot of really interesting special effects, except for a couple things, which we'll get to in a second. Great characters, great acting, great gore, and just a lot of sort of creepy stuff that have to do with magicians. So another thing right off the bat, if you are interested in magician stuff, as I am, I wanted to be a magician until I was about 10 years old, then this will be right up your alley because the setting alone will be worth it. I mentioned great special effects. The practical ones are great. Unfortunately, there are some early examples of CGI that are now just unforgiving. They've aged horribly, and they take you right out of the movie. Now, that's no one's fault. CGI was still relatively new in the mid-90s. But it is what it is. So if you watch this film, just go in knowing that there are a couple things that are just unforgivable. They look worse than a Pixar movie. It just takes you right out. But I think knowing that going in, it will help a little bit. Just other sort of like minor things. There's a note in the beginning that you can choose to read from Clive Barker that talks about the character, which I believe the character was first introduced. I'm talking about Scott Bakula's character. In Clive Barker's novel, The Damnation Game. Then I believe he appeared throughout some short stories, and I think there is a short story out there, and I want to say I read it at some point, that is essentially where this film came from. Just a very, very short version of it. But that's basically what it says in the note. I kind of wish that they'd gotten an interview like with him to introduce it, but I know he's had some issues with his throat in recent times, and I think he just got it operated on also, so I don't know if he was unable to do the interview. So if that's the case, completely understand and take back what I said. But if he was able to talk and you know, is in good health, would have liked to see an interview with him because he's very, very interesting in the way he speaks about his films, sort of give them a layer of subtext that you wouldn't have without that. The only other thing I can say that is not superb is that it is a little bit grainy, which I found kind of odd because it was made in or at least released in 95. Again, with all these Scream Factory editions, they might be working from a sort of less than stellar master, so it's completely it's forgivable when you compare it against the CGI. It's completely forgivable, but those are really the only negatives about this movie. I highly enjoyed it, and I highly recommend that if you like I said, Clive Barker, great performances, noir, sort of 90s horror films in general, and magicians, then this is going to be right up your alley. Be sure to watch the director's cut first, I think, because that's what Clive intended it to be, and I think that's probably the better of the two. Like I said, I only saw half of the theatrical when I was a kid, but judging by the practical gore that is in the director's cut, I think that's the one to go with. It's kind of light on the special features, but there is a sort of making of film that is behind the scenes, and also Clive speaking about it. And the way he's speaking about it is, or how he's able to, is because this is before his throat troubles. I'm thinking this was either included with – it's got to be the original DVD because I wouldn't think it would be on the end of a VHS. So it's interesting because it's about, you know, like 10 years prior from when I'm recording this, I would think, but also probably 10 years after the film was released. So everybody looks like a little bit older, but still younger than what they look like now. So it's kind of a trip to watch. But it's a great behind-the-scenes feature, and Clive – speaks the majority of the time, and like I said, he really gives an extra layer to his films, so you're going to want to watch that after, especially with all the sort of like subtext with the magicians and stuff. It really helps you understand the film a lot more. Other than that, it's sort of some deleted scenes and just boring stuff, and a photo gallery, which I always say I don't – if someone can understand and tell me why they include photo galleries with these films – please feel free, because I still don't understand that. But that aside, that is a A-plus from me, I guess, or an A at least, this week. Go check it out. This is Lord of Illusions from Scream Factory, and I highly enjoyed it. That is all for this week, as always. If you have a suggestion for a slightly lesser-known or obscure horror film, let the guys know on the Facebook group or shoot them an email at darkdiscussions@aol.com. I got that right this week, so take that, Phil. And I will add it to the pile if I haven't seen it. I got this film on Amazon. I think it usually goes for around 16 or 17 bucks, but they were having a Scream Factory sale, so I got it for, I want to say, 10 or 11. I got a whole stack of them. And let me tell you, in the coming weeks, this will not be the last time you hear of Scream Factory. But like I said, that's all for this week. As always, I appreciate you guys listening. And until then, take care.
All right, very well. So another Blu-ray release from one of the smaller companies like Scream Factory, whatever. Who knows what it was? We have no idea. He did not let me know.
I found that fascinating. Yeah, I don't know. On the one hand, I thought there was some that was very insightful, and on the other hand, I think it was full of shit. So I'm not really sure where I come across on that.
Well, I'm sure the listeners
come down on that. I should say. Yeah.
So. Anyway, all right. So with all that done, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're discussing the non-American movie called What We Become.
Skoven bliver så sort. Nu er solen død, mor. Og dagen gået bort.
Hvad der sker?
Der er blevet iværksat en beredskabsplan, da en ukendt sygdom, sandsynligvis en virus.
Lige nu findes der ikke nogen specifik behandling.
Hallo?
De er gået.
Vi skal væk herfra.
Det skal nok blive godt igen.
So What We Become, yes, this is a foreign language film from Denmark, Danish language film, obviously, if it's from Denmark. It is a film by a guy named Bo Mikkelsen. Bo Mikkelsen has done a number of short films, a jack of all trades on a number of short films, but otherwise this is his first feature-length film, which he also wrote, stars a number of folks. All Danish folks. However, many of them are well known in Denmark, and have actually had roles in some of Lars von Trier films. The cast, I'll just name a few of the folk, are as follows. We have Troels Leiby plays Dino, the father in the film. Millay Dennison plays Pernelia. That's the mother. Mikhail Burkshire is Casper, who is the neighbor, friend, hunter of the father. Other folks in the film, Mary Hammer Boda plays the girl next door named Sonia. Benjamin Engel as Gustav, who's pretty much the actually lead of the film. He plays the son of Dino and Pernelia. A few other folks in the film are Ella Solgaard, who plays his little sister, Maj. Or May, I'm sorry, May. M-A-J, the J is pronounced as a Y in Danish. And that's pretty much the people behind the film or in front of the cameras. And the film was released earlier this year, I think March in Denmark, and then followed throughout the world a month and a half later. A brand new film just popped up on iTunes about a week and a half ago. And that's pretty much the synopsis of the background behind the film. We'll discuss what type of film it is in a moment, but let's go around and see what everybody felt about the film. So let's go with you, Abe. Abe, what did you think of this film? And how did you hear about it, too? How did you hear about it?
Well, I think I might have caught an image, a sight of the poster, or at least the title image. Just I was browsing around for horror films, but you know, since it was another zombie film, I wasn't really giving much thought because I've seen a whole slew of them. You know, ever since this whole zombie craze blew up, and I think it was like the mid 2000s. But when we decided to, you know, give it. Do it for this recording, you know, that was when I decided to watch it. This was would be the first time I've ever watched seen it. And I feel like how I felt about the film kind of stemmed through how my entire experience with the genre itself. Because I've seen a whole slew of zombie films, from the Romero films, from the Walking Dead TV series, some of the comic issues I've read, numerous video games. I mean, the zombie genre has become this huge, huge cash cow and cultural influence that has taken on so many forms that, you know, it's hard to, like, not look, you know, take a look left or right without seeing something connected to this, to it. So, you know, I wasn't certain if there would be much to expect anything new from the film, and, well, it really didn't give me much that was all that different from what I've used to seeing in the past. I thought the acting was pretty damn good. It's not a very long film. It's only about 80 minutes long. Actually, I would say about 70 minutes, you know, if you remove credits. And it has a very slow build, which is kind of different. It was very strange that we wouldn't see zombies for a good portion of the film. Even though it's kind of maybe think of Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, where we already know what the creature is, yet they're so intent on not showing us any of them. When they were doing that, I was thinking like a unique form of zombie, but they're pretty much your standard Romero creatures. The only thing is maybe different was the their attraction to light, but I've seen it before in Land of the Dead, and I think there was another film that might have used that trick as well. I said the build-up was kind of interesting because it does pay off to quite an escalation of events. I mean, when everything snowballs into a giant shitball, it really does. But overall, it's a decent zombie flick. I mean, if you're going into it to see something new and fresh, you won't. If you want to see something that's commonly done, you will see that. I guess I would recommend it to those who really, really are into the genre. But if you're trying to find something that separates itself from what we've seen so many times before from this genre and other horror films, then I might say look elsewhere.
All right, very good. Chrissy?
I had a little bit of a different experience with this film from Abe. I heard about it because you guys said this is the film we're doing, and I know that you guys had talked about it prior, so I was aware of it. I was immediately sucked in. I think what I liked about it the most was that it actually wasn't a gross-out zombie fest. I get plenty of that on The Walking Dead. I thought that instead they were going for creepy, and that was very effective. For example, the soundless shadow moving outside the window. I loved that they did less is more. They avoided jump scares most of the time. I guess what I really was impressed with this film was that to me it was clearly not a zombie story. This is a story about emotional isolation from each other in relationships. And this is really a story about the strengthening or deteriorating of the family bond when that family is faced with a crisis. And that crisis doesn't necessarily have to be zombies. I think in this movie, the zombie apocalypse was a metaphorical stand-in for traumatic things that can happen to families and how we need to survive them and how we fall apart or come back together. Is it a movie that I'm going to want to run out and own? I don't think so. I'm not sure that I would recommend this to people that are into zombie films, because I think if they're looking for gore and real zombie type stuff, this is not it. I think if you want an interesting family drama with a little bit of a bite to it, pardon the pun, then this is probably going to be for you. I don't know if this film, however, is that memorable for me. I don't know if 5 years from now, you know, you're going to say, oh, What We Become, and I'm going to go, oh, yeah, you know, I might do what I did with The Black Cat that you mentioned. I might go, oh, did I see that? You know, I just don't know if it's going to really stick with me. But I did like it.
All right, very well. For me, I just saw it pop up on iTunes, and so I rented it a couple weeks ago, and I just re-rented it again for tonight's episode. This time you only can rent, you can't buy it. I love the apocalypse, watching apocalypse happen, and so this film has that. Again, Abe is correct, it's not necessarily original, because again, like vampires and werewolves and whatnot, we have rules, and most folks who do zombies don't really change the rules too much. They may do it a little bit here or there, but generally you're going to find similar things and themes. I absolutely agree with Chrissy about the bleakness or distance of people and the family. Film definitely has that in it. It also has a coming of age, I think, too, between Sonya and Gustav. Unfortunately, during a time of peril, it also has the government is quote unquote bad, or are they actually not bad because they're just doing something to prevent the destruction of humanity? But it definitely has a commentary on that. The film actually reminded me of an Argentinian film called Phase 7 that came out a couple of years ago. Similar type of theme. Prior to the actual zombie apocalypse. The acting was absolutely splendid, as Abe said. For a zombie film, I think it hits the mark. It's definitely a film that anybody who loves zombies would love. Abe did has an excellent point, though, that when I really think about it, yeah, the zombies aren't shown all that often, because, again, it's the apocalypse as it's happening, and so the zombies don't really appear until the very end of the film. I think it is effective enough and does that well enough that anybody who enjoys zombies or the end of the world films would like. I actually regret that the last time I watched the film, I didn't have my wife watch it because she likes the infection spreading disease films. And this film would definitely fit that bill. I would recommend it. It's definitely worth checking out. A well-made film, and the director behind it, Mikkelsen, most certainly seems like he knows how to make motion pictures. Eric?
I think I'm pretty much on the same page as Abe. But I want to be careful. It's going to be hard for me to talk about this movie because I don't want to disparage anybody who was involved with the making of the movie, because the movie was well made. The directing was fine. The acting was fine. It looked good. It's a well-made movie. But in the end, I agree with Abe. It's just another zombie movie. I've seen it all before. The only difference is this one has subtitles, so it really didn't do a whole lot for me in that regard.
not because of the quality of the filmmaking, but just because I mean, I've said it on the podcast before, I've been zombied out for a while now, and this is just more of the same.
All right, very good. Mike?
Well, I've mentioned before on the podcast that I think it's impossible for me to get zombied out. But I certainly understand it. This is a film that I think loses points on originality, but scores them on execution. I think everybody here sort of said what I could say. Whether you enjoy it or not is going to depend on where you are with the zombie phenomenon right now. I think this is a pretty classic zombie story. Like a lot of zombie stories, as Christy said, it's really not about the zombies. It's about the people and just dealing with the issue. And I think for people who watched, who still watch and continue to watch The Walking Dead and are more wrapped up in the interpersonal drama than they are with the zombie drama, this is something you would like. And I think I would especially recommend it for people who were interested in seeing Fear of the Walking Dead and hoping to get a little bit more of the slow rollout of the zombie apocalypse and didn't really get it. I think this would be more what you were looking for, because you really do go at least halfway through the film, and it's not a very long film. It's only 80-something minutes, I think. This is really what you're looking for. It's a lot more about how are the people treated when the outbreak happens, how does the government respond, how are people responding to each other, and how we, you know, often end up being our own worst enemies because we don't trust what the government's doing. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yep, very well. Just a couple more things about the film or Denmark itself. The film actually has another title, the Danish title, which is actually just the name of where it's from, where it all takes place. And that is simply Sorgenfri, which is actually a small section of a municipality called Langby Tabak, which is in the Hovedstaden region on the island of Zealand or Svalland. And that is actually just pretty much a suburb of Copenhagen, which is the capital of Denmark. With that, I guess we'll throw up the spoiler. But before we do the spoiler, Eric, do you got a wiki?
Hang on. My computer went to sleep.
Sounds like a Hawaiian drink, a wiki.
A family of four is quarantined in their home as a virulent strand of the flu spreads into town, and they are forced to the extreme to escape alive. Well, I don't know about that, but okay.
All right, so let's throw up the spoiler and let's talk about the film. Basically the family of four is mother and father, which is Dina as the guy and Pernelia as the woman. And then Gustav is the teenage son, probably around 16 maybe, and his younger sister, who's probably around maybe 9 or 8, or maybe even 7 or 8, named May. And that's the family. And May has a pet
rabbit.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, May has a pet rabbit named Ninu. Basically, it's a normal, what appears to be middle-class neighborhood. A new neighbor across the street moved in with her two parents. Her name is Sonia, same age as Gustav. And a number of neighbors, including Casper and his wife or girlfriend, we're not quite sure, but they live together, Anna, are pretty much the main cast. There's a number of other folks as well. The neighborhood has every age range from senior citizen retirees all the way down to, as I said, the young children. Where do we want to start? Anyone? Anyone want to bring anything up? Chrissy, I know you mentioned something about the family dynamic.
Yeah, this was interesting. The first thing I noticed was that there is so much emotional distance in this family. And their house is very interesting, too, because the house is all white. So it kind of signifies that there's a lot of bland. There's not too much going on in their world. But emotionally, they're very distanced. For example, you know, there's that classic moment where the wife says to the husband who is Dino, he seems like kind of a man-child. He's kind of playful. He doesn't really want to take anything seriously. The little girl watches TV all the time and just tunes everything out. We clearly see that the son, Gustav, doesn't share anything with his parents, which is typical of a teen. But when his dad comes into his room later when he's playing video games, you really do see that he has absolutely no emotional connection to his father. His father basically comes in, says, "What are you doing? Oh, look, that video game you're playing is violent," and leaves. The father doesn't even really know what's going on in the son's world, because he would know that his son is playing violent video games if he were in there more often.
Right. The son responds, says something like, "Well, you watch a lot of TV, and this is less violent than what you see on the news." And he's like, "Well played," and leaves. You know, there's really has no counter argument.
Actually, it goes down like this. It basically goes in, and he says, "Oh, the video game you're playing is pretty violent." And he goes, "Well, no worse than the news. And unlike the news, this is pretend." And then father goes, "Well, you seem like you play video games a lot." And he goes, "I play a lot less time playing video games than you watch TV." And then the father basically looks at him, says, "Well," you know, pats him on the back and walks out, and is basically what you said, Mike, which is, "Well played, son, well played." And that's pretty much it. That was, I have to agree, Chrissy, that scene demonstrated that, not only is the father clueless, but, there's no connection between the two. Whether or not it's saying something about Denmark or just society in general or people in general, probably, but because
it's a teenager
and a son, a teenager son and a father, that type of stuff you can see happen a lot anyway, right?
Right, but I think it's more just in general about the relationships too, and there's a whole comment running through this film about the different points in romantic relationships as well, which we can talk about later. But I think, you know, that first scene where Pernille is like, she feels very, that's the wife, she feels very isolated in the raising of their children. And she says to him, "I thought we were doing this together." And he's like, "Ha ha." And then he kisses her. But as the movie progresses, which is also something I wanted to talk about, but later, they get more physically intimate later on. In the beginning, when he kisses her, it's a quick, you know, typical husband and wife, been married for a lot of years, let me kiss you and go out the door. And as the movie progresses, they get more and more intimate. And the director made a point to show that. He's just got a few moments where they're laying in bed. Then a few scenes later, when things get worse, they're cuddling. Then a few scenes later, things get worse. Now they're on top of each other. It's just interesting how that evolved, which is why I kind of thought this movie was really more about relationships than anything else.
Right. I like the scene at the beginning when the wife is trying to be funny with the husband in the kitchen, where he's like whistling and it annoys her, but not truly negatively, and she's just starts talking about a story, and then immediately when she turns around, he's already gone because he's outside walking with his best friends Casper and Anna to go off to the local block party, and he just leaves her there, and she's like, "Okay, whatever, you know, like, what the hell is that about?" So yeah, I mean, even though they're married and whatnot, he has other interests that interest him more than his own family, just as it appears Gustav does and whatnot. So, it's typical steel, quote-unquote, white picket fence family, I guess. Now, anybody else have any further thoughts about the family itself? Mike, Abe, Eric?
It's your typical middle class white family, which is pretty much what they have in Norwegia, wherever this is. Where is this again?
Denmark.
They're all
Swedes.
Yeah, they're all a bunch of white people. And in case you can't
figure out that they're really white, they named one of the characters Casper. So,
That's a very common name in Denmark, actually.
But yeah, it's you know, so you have your family, husband, wife, you know, daughter and son. Son is, you know, is older and he's doing his typical, you know, adolescent rebellious thing. I don't think there's anything all that unique or significant in a bad way. You know, that's teenagers do tend to get that a lot with their parents, where there's not a lot of connection going on.
He's running on hormones.
Yeah. And yeah, and he's only interested in the hot chick across the way, who takes her shirt off every night so he can look at her in her bra.
Oh, what a dumbass. I mean, he doesn't learn that you're supposed to shut off the light inside your own house so they can't look in to see that you're using the binoculars to, you know, look at her.
Well, we can't all be an expert like you, Phil.
Eric, you know how I know about this? It's because you know how I know about this is because me and you did an episode on Rear Window, episode number 11.
Oh,
or
that's
9.
True. That's true. Yeah,
yeah. And he goes, turn off the light, turn off the light. James Stewart.
Telling
Grace Kelly to
turn off the light.
Yeah, because Thurber or whatever his name is across the alleyway was looking in and saw that they were watching with binoculars.
Yeah. So, and you know, the girl is a typical, what is she, about 6-7-year-old girl?
You mean the sister? You mean the sister?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you were just because you were just talking about a hot chick across the way with that wears a bra, and she ain't going to be 6.
Well, right. So hopefully, he can make that jump. Anyway, so the daughter is about 6 or 7. Right. What would you say, Christy? 6, 7.
The sister, yeah.
Yeah, I would say 6 or 7. She was pretty young, but old enough to be, you know, articulate. Not
right,
like
and
5.
I don't,
she was too old.
Right,
for
and you
5,
see, mom.
She's
you
definitely
see mom, like reading her bedtime stories. She's got a baby bunny, and you know, she's also a fairly typical kid of that age. You know, it's an innocent, naive, and that won't last long. You have the older couple who are sort of at the end of their relationship. You have Casper and what's her name, Anna.
Yep.
Anna. Yeah.
Anna, who are in that, you know, that adult phase. They've been together, but they're not quite married with children yet. And of course, with the teenage son, you have him at the very beginning of a relationship with the next door neighbor.
Yeah, Sonia.
So yeah, so I mean, so you're right, Chris, I hadn't picked up that, but they do have that all laid out, like the entire relationship spectrum.
Yeah. And it's just interesting to see where they're all at in different stages. And like, there's that one really cool moment where Casper and Anna are sitting there watching the hand washing thing. And, you know, Anna, he coughs and Anna moves away from him on the couch. But in the opening, when they're at the block party, they are all over each other. I mean, they're just like doing the whole PDA thing big time. And now here she's shifting away from him.
Yeah, it's actually very. I was going to add that it creates actually a parallel. The family's distant before the disease hits, but once the disease hits, they kind of come together.
Yep.
This couple is close together before the disease, but once the disease hits, they spread apart.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah. Yep. I didn't think of that, but holy crap. Yep. You're totally right.
They're at that point in the relationship where they don't have that background, that thing that's going to hold them together necessarily.
Right.
Where, you know, once you're married for a while, it's sort of like, well, fuck, I made my choice. I'm going to have to roll with some of the punches. Whereas, you know, if that was something, you know, some stuff that might have happened earlier in the relationship, you would have been, you know what, I'm not committed. Fuck you. I'm out of here.
Yeah. Which is interesting because that's kind of what Anna does. Remember,
yeah.
She tries to get away in the car, and she's just like, oh, no, I'm out of here. And she tries to leave, like, 2 or 3 times, doesn't she?
Oh,
yeah,
she's
trying to leave.
The cop,
the law kind of forces her to stay.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. But you also have, too, the contrast of the coming of age, where, you know, I mean, the married couple, Dino and Pernille, are in this pristine white of their home. Suggest that, you know, that the magic has kind of gone out of their lives. You have these little pops of color throughout the house, like a green chair or like, I don't know, freaking red lampshade or whatever. which is kind of interesting, which was interesting to me because it's almost like a parallel, you know, when you're in a relationship that long and things are just kind of plodding along, you know, you just get sort of used to each other. It just becomes, everything becomes old hat. Once in a while you get, ooh, an exciting date night, or you get a, ooh, you get a spark of this or a spark of that. But many times, and this is not the case with every single marriage in the universe, I'm not saying that at all, but in many marriages, that's what happens, and you get that pop of color. So that was interesting how the director kind of chose the home that they were in to sort of reflect and tell the story of what their marriage, the state of their marriage, the state that their marriage was in. And then you get Gustav, and he's shooting the fireworks out there for Sonya, which is kind of like, to me, represented the beginning of the relationship, the sparks, the sex, you know, the excitement and the, you know. And of course they would have sex in after her mother dies, because there is a statistic out there that says that I think there somebody did a study and found out that there is more sex that happens after funerals than like at any other time, because people feel such a loss that they need to reaffirm life, so they end up having sex. I read this years ago. I wish I could find the article that I read it in. It was Scientific Magazine, though. It was decent. It wasn't like some rag or something. It was something.
It wasn't Hustler or something, yes.
No.
I saw it happen on Game of Thrones.
Yes. Yes, yeah. We did see that happen.
Yeah.
Right, in front of the body.
Well, that just always stuck with me. And I was young when I read that. I was maybe, 15 or 16 years old. I was still clearly a virgin, didn't even really understand it. But that fact just stuck with me my whole life. And to this day, I've Googled it, but nothing has come up. But someday I'm going to find that article, and then I will read it to all of you so we can use it for further movie analysis.
And shortly after she learned that fact, Christy started assassinating people and going up to the cute guys at school saying, "Oh, are you sad?"
Oh, good Lord. That would be something Mike would say, not you, Eric. Come on. So,
interrupted.
Eric, what about yourself? What did you think of this family? Actually, not just the family, but the family, the neighbors, Anna and Casper, as well as the girl across the street, Sonya.
I mean, it was all portrayed in a very realistic manner, very realistic family dynamics. I can't really add to anything that's been said.
Alright, very well. All right, so Eric, let's talk about the block party. We talked a little bit about it where we see Anna and Casper making out, and Dino and Pernilla suddenly feel uncomfortable, not just because they're making out, but for the fact that exactly. And so to reaffirm, they go, "Oh, can I buy you, get your beer?" "Yeah, yeah, sure. Thank you very much." You know, and let's talk about all that block party, and what happens with the older woman and whatnot. Because I guess that's the beginning of the first incident of, possible zombie outbreak.
The old lady says her husband is acting weird, and so we know he's a zombie.
Well, yeah, because we know it's a zombie film, right? So,
but it was cool. It was cool, yeah. Though, how they – I mean, we all went into this knowing that it was a zombie film, but one of the things I really enjoyed about this particular zombie film was that we were allowed to experience some of the mystery as it was unfolding. Even though we knew it was zombies, we didn't get to see anything that the characters didn't see. So it was kind of cool to watch it unfold without really understanding how it was going to unfold. Like, I liked how you just saw the guy, you know, that the husband's missing. They on their way to the picnic, is it Gustav sees the kid throwing up in the hay pile.
That's right, yeah.
It was just these little subtle, there was a car accident, but nothing more is explained. You just see a guy dead on the road and he's bleeding and that's it. I liked how I was surprised.
And Christy, yeah. And then you see the emergency vehicles come and they just keep on going because they're going to something else instead of the car accident.
Right, yeah. It's just, I liked how that was done because I could turn off in my brain that I was expecting zombies and just kind of enjoy living these crazy puzzles with these characters and going, huh, that's weird. Like, you know, it was, that's one of the things I liked. But anyway, I'll shut up.
Right. And it's not like, you know, we've talked recently about, say, like something like Black Swan, which is from one character's perspective. So it isn't the same thing here, but it's limiting perspective in that we're only seeing from the people, and we're only seeing from a select group of people. We don't, but you still get it from multiple points of view. If you're following.
Yeah, it's pretty much points of views like the seven main characters, which is the four family members, the Casper, Anna, and then Sonya across the street, and that's it.
But I think that's easier to do. At least to me, I would think it's easier to do because this is such a familiar trope, right? Is that we all know the zombies. And they're not doing anything unusual here. They don't have fast zombies like in World War Z or, you know, zombies that fly or spit acid or some weird shit like that. They're basically your standard generic zombies. So you don't have to get into any detail on that. And you can focus on the characters because we've seen it enough that we can fill in all the blanks. Right, that we it doesn't matter that we're jumping ahead, you know, that we're five steps ahead of the characters because we've seen it before because we're focusing on the character dynamics, not on the outbreak itself, or at least not at first.
Yes, exactly, and it was well done how it began. I mean that's the reason why I love watching the fall rather than the zombies after the fall because it's just interesting and. I kind of enjoyed it. Now, Abe, why don't you talk about the whole incident about the old woman and how Dino is basically forced to go in to look. Because this, I mean, even though we know it's a zombie, as Eric said, the zombie's not there, right?
Yeah. At first we're thinking we're going to have our first zombie encounter, incident to kick off everything. The show did something really wrong, but instead we're left with a fake out. Because the woman describes her husband sitting in a chair in front of the TV, who has his face turned blue, not breathing. But when he goes there, the TV's still running, but there's no sign of the husband anywhere. But later that night, the woman wakes up hearing the dog bark, her dog bark. And soon the dog's crying out in pain. She goes to investigate, turn a corner, and sees something, someone sitting in the chair in front of the TV, which I think is just simply a static. She tries to get a response, and she looks across to see what she sees. But it horrifies her enough that she's attacked and killed off screen. We don't even see the death on screen. We just see a blood splatter, but... It's one of those. It's just another moment of subtlety, and just a little more mystery. Even though, as we all agree, we know it's zombies. We just don't see everything happen, though.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool too, how they did that. And again, we all know it's zombies. And the thing that made I think the film better than a regular zombie film is, Chrissy, you made a good point. We didn't have to see the gore, even though folks love gore, you know, horror fans love that stuff. This is a different way to do it, I guess. And to see this way being done in a zombie film itself is somewhat original because usually you expect in a zombie film blood and guts, right? Don't you, Mike? I mean, you're a connoisseur of zombie stuff, right?
Yeah, well, that's always been one of the things, although... They're certainly going back to at least Dawn of the Dead. Night of the Living Dead is really, really tame by modern standards. But, yeah, you can look at Return of the Living Dead. You can look at any of the Romero films. And obviously you can look at Walking Dead, which is constantly pushing the boundaries for what you can do on gore on TV. And can get away with a lot because you're doing things to corpses as opposed to people most of the time. But... You know, and I've always maintained that that's a great, you know, sauce on top of it. But the key idea for zombie films is always that it allows you to explore the characters rather than worry about,
you know, the monster and the rules of the monster and what's their motivation, what's the plan. It's simply about who the people are.
And Mike, one thing I liked about this film too is that even though we know it's a zombie film, and eventually they're going to figure out it's zombies, the whole film up until the very end, they don't even know it's zombies. They don't know the people are dying and coming back to life and becoming walking dead. They just hear that people are getting sick on the news. There's quarantine, basically. I mean, it's not even a quarantine at first. At first, it's for folks who are in the Sorgan-free area should stay on their side of the river.
Don't go to a hospital, call this number, stay in your home.
Don't call 911, call some other number, which, you know, but go on, Mike.
Yeah, so it's your typical emergency situation. I did kind of find it funny that, what was it, the translation from English was that it's the National, the National Serum Institute or something like that.
Yeah, but it was the National Serum Institute, and then later on they mentioned Russia.
Right.
And they mentioned some weird, like, Vertok or something like that, which didn't make any sense. It's kind of interesting.
Well, what it is the Danish government is sending getting help from other foreign governments, basically. So they talk about how stuff has been sent to the U.S. for testing. The Russians have sent a large conglomerate of scientists and doctors and have set up just outside of Sorgan Free on the other side of the river closer to Copenhagen to help figure out what's going on. They do have this. Again, this is all off screen. And again, we're only going through the perspective of these seven folk, basically, right?
It's through their perspective. But right, so and we're seeing it sort of slowly play out. And again, it takes about almost the first hour, I think, to really get to the what we recognize as the zombie outbreak of the zombie outbreak.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's the thing, Mike. I thought when if we didn't know this was a zombie film and we just were watching the film, or if this was real life and we're watching TV, and they suddenly something pops up that says if you're sick, don't go to the hospital, and if you're an emergency, don't call 911. Instead, call this other number. I would be start like, oh, there's something bad here. So but again, we don't know enough details to really panic, I guess, completely. But it's enough that that's weird because, you know, you're expected to go to 911 in an emergency room, and they're telling you not to do either of those things.
Well, it's one of those movies that I almost wish I had no idea it was a zombie film. I mean, I would have figured it out, but it would have been a lot more fun if I had no idea going into it. Like, if I didn't know if it was a virus or a zombie or a vampire thing or an alien thing or some other. It just would have made the whole – all those little reveals a lot more fun if I went into it – if I'd gone into it completely blind.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. Now, Eric, you've been pretty quiet. And it's probably because you're zombified out, but up to this point, basically maybe to where it starts appearing on the TV and Gustav and Sonya are in the forest to go to the fishing hole, I guess, and they find the blood. What do you got to say about any of this? Any points you wanted to bring up? Any scenes?
No, I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk or anything. I just really don't have anything to say about this movie because I knew everything that was going to happen before it happened, and I was just sitting there watching, and then it was over. So, yeah.
All right. No, that's fair. Abe, Chrissy, or Mike, or even you, Eric, if you did want to add anything. The relationship between the new neighbor, Sonya, and Gustav?
It's pretty much teenage romance. It's nothing out of the ordinary, really. I mean, aside from the circumstances kind of hastening its growth. Considering, at first, they're trying to get to know each other, just walking through the woods. But, you know, they discover the slaughtered deer, and then everything else starts happening. And, you know, her losing her mother and everything, you know, just everything is falling apart. They begin to cling on to each other, and that kind of creates a sort of a support for each other. This is especially due to the fact that Gustav is very distant from his family and finds himself a lot more closer to Sonya than he is to either her mother, father, or even his little sister. In fact, I don't remember much interaction between Gustav and his sister at all. So, you know, Sonya becomes a very important person to him. And Sonya finds Gustav her main lifeline, his only lifeline, especially by the end of the film.
Everything you said, Abe, I'm agreeing 100% with you.
It's your typical teenage romance that you get in the vast majority of horror films. They're young, they're hot, they're horny.
Yeah, well, that's
and the parents just don't understand them.
I would say the relationship is more than just obviously it's standard for horror films, but I mean it was fairly pretty realistic, I think, though. I mean I could see 2 16-year-olds in real life, you know, behaving like this. So I'll give it more credit than just saying it's a standard horror trope.
Well, I thought it was there as a direct contrast to kind of make a comment on, you know, where their parents are. Like I said, their parents' relationship is sort of dead. And so this was a direct contrast. Just like Abe said, the other relationship was a parallel in that, you know, Anna and Casper's grew apart as the apocalypse was coming. But also there is some, you know, every character, the title of this movie, What We Become, is really not, it's one of those great titles because it works on two levels. It works on the zombie level, but it also works as a comment on how all these people change. You know, Gustav basically becomes a man, and I thought that that was kind of what their relationship was really there for, because he is, in the end, the only survivor in that family.
Yep.
He becomes a man. Dino becomes a man as well, because he's always been this playful man-child who doesn't want to take responsibility, but by the end of the film, he does. The mother begins to value her children and her husband and becomes more emotionally available to them as the movie progresses. So I think that yes, it was the typical teenage horror thing, but because of all of the other relationship stuff going on in this movie, it wasn't just your typical, oh, here's kids going in the woods to smoke pot or whatever. And it was really nice to see people smoking. I forget that in far, you know, nobody in America smokes anymore. Nobody. It's only in Europe, I guess.
Well, the other thing about What We Become is addressed kind of early in the film, which is that we do all also become corpses. And they have the little girl make a comment when they're talking about, you know, that somebody had died and, you know, that they're turned blue. And she says, well, I hope I die before you do, Mommy, because I don't want to have to see you, you know, turn blue. And, yep. You know, and that is eventually the path that we are all on. And we all go through, like, these their various stages in the relationships, from the young child to the teenager, you know, to, you know, the couple, to the married couple, to the couple with children, to the old couple who's just waiting until death. You know, and then eventually we die. So that's another part of, I think, What We Become, because that is what we become.
Mm-hmm. We die in many ways, and I think that's part of what this movie is trying to say too, is that we all die in many ways. Although, did anybody else this is an interesting thing. I thought image-wise it was very interesting when they were pulling, and this is kind of going off the topic we just said, but they were pulling everybody into the trucks and then bringing them to the school. It really had a very Holocaust-type feel to it. I don't know if anybody else picked up on that.
Yeah, I can see that. It's definitely I think because the way it was presented, I could understand to an extent why Gustav assumed that there was something very shady going on, because he could never really see what the people had become or if they were sick. all he was seeing was just look like innocent people just being dragged off to be slaughtered.
Yeah, before I bring that up, I just want to go back to one thing that Christy said about the smoking, and I thought that was a pretty good scene, not just because, oh, people are smoking in film again, but because it was where the two teenagers are connect a little more, and they also are, it's like almost like their little rebellion against their parents, and I thought that was kind of quaint, I guess. But Abe, yeah, I think the problem what the government did was is they were being obviously the whoever's in the charge of government at this time in this film in Denmark were morons, because instead of telling the folks, you know, going door to door saying, yeah, the reason we need you all to stay in your house, this is the reason why some people are becoming crazy, and it spreads when they become crazy, and they may attack you, and then you could get the disease as well, and then you could go crazy. You know, in other words, explain it as if it was rabies or something like that. But instead, they immediately come into the neighborhood or the whole town or Sorgenfree to basically be a police state where they just have guns pointing them at people, especially in Europe. I mean, you know, in the U.S., you know, everybody has guns, so we see them all the time. But in Europe, the only times people see guns is either in war or maybe as security, you know, during because of a terrorist thing or something like that. And so suddenly you have all these cops and military folks pointing guns at people, not explaining why they want you to go back in the house, and treating the citizens as you know, you would be treated in Soviet Russia. And so, I mean, for anybody to believe the government's evil in this film, you would say, yeah, I think government's evil. Look what they're doing. And whether that's the intent of the director or not, or he was just showing a complete breakdown, I don't know. But if they had done it, if the government had came in and treated everybody civilly and explained, you know, this is the reason why we're doing this without pointing guns except as a last resort, then I think it could have went down a little better. But yeah, Abe, you were going to say something?
Yeah, well, it became an example of well-intentioned extreme action, mainly because it's, I guess, the government had discovered that the disease was completely fatal, and it was spreading so quickly, which is why they were so desperate to keep anyone from leaving the area. And it's it you question if had Gustav not let the zombies out of the crates, how this method would have worked out. You know, it probably would not have stopped the entire thing, but would it have got so out of control like it just did since Gustav let them out?
Well, I think you have a problem in that we all have this weird assumption in films that the people in government are far better at their jobs than they really are. And one of the tropes of any zombie film and zombie story, of course, is that there are no zombie films. So nobody says, oh my God, it's finally the zombie apocalypse. And you don't have people who've been preparing for the zombie apocalypse and watching Walking Dead or watching the Romero films. So they don't really know the story. And so you assume this is a brand new thing. Anytime, despite what conspiracy theorists will say, well, this is what they said the first 5 minutes of the disaster, and then they changed their story. Well, yeah, because usually they don't know what the hell they're talking about the first 5 minutes of the story. You know, it takes time to get all the information. There's always a lot of misinformation out there, and it takes time for that to get sorted out. And so we don't really know what the government knows, what it doesn't know. We do see that they're watching, like, you know, racing on TV, that they're not really watching the news broadcast very much, that they're not listening to it. So we don't know how much information they're being given and how much they're just ignoring and how much is really known by the government. So, yeah, if they knew more, they could probably say more. They are telling people it's a bad outbreak, better stay in your homes, lock the doors, you know, and we don't know what they have and haven't been told, and we don't know what the government does and doesn't know. But I can also understand why the government doesn't want to say, we're rounding up your loved ones, taking them to a school and executing them.
Right. Yeah, that's a fair point. Because that would go down badly no matter what.
But
well, it does. Look what I mean. When it eventually gets found out, how do they react?
Right, right. Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like what do you do? How else could have the government have done this? I mean, could they have said the people who are infected, you know, we're going to have to take them, try to get them quarantined, whatever, or would this be the typical chaos where people go, oh my God, and start going crazy and just attacking, you know, breaking windows, whatever. And I don't know. So did the Danish military government decide to, in this case, decide to just do it this way because, okay, let's just slam it down and that's that. And not, then we won't have to worry about an extra thing, which is chaos. Or were they just incompetent fools when they could have, you know, tried to do it in a more, I guess, first world way?
Well, I think when Christy says it's reminiscent of the Holocaust, I don't know any way to show the government rounding up people to be executed that won't be reminiscent of the Holocaust. Hitler kind of ruined governments rounding up people for execution like that. We're always just going to assume it's for bad purposes. Although in this case, it's not, right? It's
right, right.
Well, no, I think you're right. I was just making a reference to the way they did it visually, where the big trucks kind of looked like the train cars.
Right.
And the school really looked like some of the pictures of the concentration campsite scene. I was just purely talking visual. It just leapt out at me. I was like, oh, okay. So they went.
And that's the reason why at the beginning I said the government is quote unquote doing evil, or are they just being smart? And no matter what, whether the director was trying to portray the government as a police state like Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia or any other, you know, Saddam Hussein's Iraq or whatnot, or if he was just trying to have it through the perspective of these seven people, which is when seven people that don't know much see this happening, they say, oh my God, the government is doing terrible things. This is where, you know, this is just like the concentration camps. So I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, the thing is, when it comes to that kind of thing, I don't necessarily think you have to separate smart and evil as far as the government actions go. Because in a situation like that, I think it would actually be incredibly irresponsible for the government not to try and quarantine everybody who was infected. So does it suck? Absolutely. But is it something they should do? Yeah, probably. As much as it sucks for the people who are in there, that I would have to say would be the right thing for the government to do at that point. So evil, yeah, kind of, but smart, yeah. I mean, they gotta try something to stop this disease that they don't know how to cure.
Right, and I remember a number of years ago on the state exam for biology, they had a question that was terribly worded because it was a series of questions that were dealt with AIDS. And then the last question was, how can you or suggest one way to prevent the spread of a disease such as AIDS? Now, the fact that they used the term such as really opened the door because they didn't say what that meant. A viral disease, a fatal disease, a sexually transmitted disease, you know, what was it? And so kids being teenagers who have their life through the media and not real experience would say things like, you know, execute them. Well, and then that led to a debate among staff and teachers online across the state, what are acceptable answers? And when some kids said, round up the people with the disease and put them into camps, people said, oh, that's horrible, you can't do that. And I said, but that's called quarantine, right? Right. I mean, you round up the people, or isolate, you round up the people who have them and keep them from mixing with others. That's quarantine. When you say don't kill people, well, that's what we do, or kill the ones who have it. That's what we do with mad cow disease. It's what we do with livestock and rabies. Now, you could argue about the legality of it. New York State eventually said they can't say that because that's illegal. It's like, well, you didn't say anything about legal or ethical in your question, dumbass. The kids were answering based on the parameters they were given. And I'm not endorsing all of their answers, but somebody will try those different approaches.
Right, and so, just like you said, Mike, they mostly live through the media. So this is not a real-world experience. They have never been faced with this. So they're going to answer on the basis of, this is what I see them do in movies, or this is what I see on the video game, or whatever, you know?
Right, and this is not long after movies like Outbreak and 28 Days Later had been out, you know, which is, those are disease-related films. You know, this is the early 2000s. So they see that, you know, and what was the thing in Outbreak? Well, nuke California to stop the outbreak of the disease. Right, that was their solution.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
and
so
it's,
I mean,
still a good one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, and let's be honest, this wasn't a case of they immediately moved in and start shooting people on sight, which is what we see in a lot of movies. They were quarantined for at least a couple of days, probably a couple of weeks. They were feeding them. They were giving them fresh water. Even as rations and supplies were running down, which was our sign that things were getting out of control outside the quarantine zone, was because they keep getting smaller amounts of food.
Yeah.
Right.
And you mentioned how the internet keeps going out and power keeps going out and, you know, stuff that we would take for granted as standard infrastructure.
And then they're out of gas. They run out of gas.
Yeah, gas meaning
for the stove,
propane for the stove. Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to be getting the propane truck, you know, during this time coming to fill your tank. You know, it just ain't going to happen.
And it was also interesting that they draped everything in these trash bags. Like, I don't know.
It was like
trash bags.
Top.
I don't know what else.
They looked like fumigation tents or something.
Yeah,
something like that.
I was calling them pool tarps.
Pool tarps, yeah. But they cover the houses, and at first I was like, why are they doing that? So it was interesting that these zombies, when light was their big attractor, as opposed to sound.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think of that.
That was kind of different. I'll give them props for that, because that was a little bit different than the normal noise and all of this. Because when they turned off the light, the zombie stopped and turned around and walked away. And I thought that was kind of different.
They were also quiet, so I don't know if sound was or was not a trigger.
Well,
the other thing is, this was a disease.
I was going to comment to the tarps being similar to like body bags almost. Giant body bags.
My God, yeah.
Score one for symbolism. But this was a quarantine, so this was partly them sealing them off and hoping to contain whatever's in the house.
Although the houses are starting to become coffins, really, because the situation was not improving. You know, they were going to die in there, so it was like a body bag and a coffin in one.
Well, that's the problem with that kind of quarantine, is that you're going to get the healthy in with the sick. But are you willing to accept a certain amount of healthy people dying to prevent a larger, uncertain number of healthy people from getting sick in the first place?
Mike, they did have one test, something to do with your tongue, right?
They were looking at in your mouth. But again, I think, remember, for those of us who lived through the early days of the AIDS epidemic, there was a lot of myths and misinformation about how that got spread. You know, people were afraid to use public toilets, for example.
Yeah,
or you had like Ryan White, who was the boy who
the dentist.
Could you get it from the dentist?
He contracted it from the dentist. Ryan White.
I thought it was hemophiliac or whatever it was, but it was a boy who had AIDS. Parents were trying to keep him out of school because they were afraid, like that if he, you know, their kid sat next to him, they might get it. Well, this is a new disease. They don't know if it's like rodents or insects could transfer it. So it kind of makes sense that they seal them off completely to keep anything from coming in or out, including bunnies.
Well, and also, too, what I thought was cool was that later on, you know, when the kid rips a hole in the plastic to see, and he peers out and he kind of sees what's going on, where they're leading, you know, Sonya's father, you know, up off to the truck, that it was also used as a device to keep those who were quarantined from seeing what was going on outside.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it served many purposes. Symbolic as well, too, because there's the whole, like Abe was saying, the whole body bag in the coffin, but also it has to do with perception and how we are blind to, you know, maybe the threats that are outside our own door at all times. And again, not just a disease or a zombie threat, but that we just walk around blind and oblivious, and we get all into our own thing and we're not paying attention to what's going on in the larger scheme of what's outside our front door. Metaphorically speaking.
Ignorance and there's also, is the best.
Yeah, and there is also a tendency for people in government to want to classify everything. The old saying, you know, knowledge and power is true, but sometimes people become so obsessed about controlling that information that they don't want anything to get out, even when it really doesn't matter. Right? Or that they don't trust how people will handle it. So right, so they lead the father out on a leash with a hood over his head. Now we know he's a zombie because we've seen this before, but they don't because nobody said this is a zombie outbreak. And here, watch this movie from 1968; it'll explain the whole thing to you. This is a mistake on their part that they're restricting the flow of information to control some power and thinking that they're going to give more information to the people, but that's what ends up backfiring completely.
Now, Mike, let me ask you this. Being a zombie connoisseur, people were getting the disease just from the air or something at first? I mean, obviously, if you get bit, you become infected too, but the original folks, and there was a good number of them, were getting it from what? Something we just don't know how, right? Because they weren't bit, they weren't, they didn't die and rise.
No, any disease, it's really hard to pinpoint where does it come from. What's the original vector? How did it end up in the population? And I don't think they really address that. It's just the disease pops up.
I think it was implied, just in a comment that the mother makes to the daughter. When the daughter at one point says she hopes she dies before her mother because she doesn't want to see her mother turn all blue. And her mother says, well, the scientists are working on a pill that will allow us to live forever. So just in my head, I was thinking that the virus was in a lab somewhere and got out.
I missed that completely. I mean, I heard that comment, but I thought it was more like the mother just telling the daughter a line of bullshit, but wow, you're right.
I don't know if you've actually paid attention to current events, but they really are working on stuff to help us live forever.
Oh, I know. It's kind of creepy as fuck.
Right, so that's probably why I didn't even pay attention to that line, because it's kind of true. I guess that might have been a, because thinking about when they would have made this, and this has really just been the last couple of months that I'm hearing more and more talk about it. They probably would have been ahead of the curve. So, yeah, that's a reasonable hypothesis. I like it. And
I don't know if I'd want to live forever.
Oh, fuck no.
Yeah.
Who wants to live forever?
Well, there's
you are not Freddie Mercury. Thank you very much.
There's no, because he didn't live forever. There's two questions I would want answered on that. Is one, what is your biological state of living forever?
Yeah, that's right. True.
And two, do I have the option of terminating that, or am I going to live forever no matter what? You know, if I throw myself in a meat grinder, am I going to be an eternal sentient blob of plasm? Because at least that way, if I get to the point where, you know what, fuck it, I'm bored, I don't need to see Captain America 93.
All right, we're getting off topic here a little bit.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. So let's talk about that whole setup. I mean, we kind of, you know, gone over a little bit about, you know, throwing the top
over the houses and all this other stuff. Let's talk about Casper and Anna and how Anna just immediately just because her husband slash boyfriend begins to cough, she immediately just assumes he's sick. And yet oddly, by the end of the film, it turns out to be the other way around. And how she just keeps on trying to escape from the house and is forced back in by the government. And yet he, Casper, oddly sticks to his guns the whole time. He does not turn on his wife slash girlfriend at all. Let's talk about that a little bit, and then the lead up to the school and the trucks. Who wants to go? Abe, what about you?
Once things start to deteriorate after Gustav lets the dead out of the trucks, everyone starts to take a chance. So Anna decides uses it as her chance to bugger off and takes the car and just leaves the poor bastard behind. And Casper decides to survive on his own with his rifle. Meanwhile, Gustav, actually I think it's Dino and Gustav taking Sonja and her mother. They're not aware that the mother was bit by her crazed husband, who was taken away in an earlier scene. And even the wife is unhappy about this the whole development because of how very little food they had, because most of their food came from the soldiers, and well, the soldiers are not going to be around anymore because they're feeding someone else now.
And this is really where the movie lost me, because really, I never, ever, ever, ever want to see another person in a zombie movie hide their bite because, oh, they won't turn. Oh, God, I just hate it.
It's a very common use of theme in the zombie genre, and it works out just as well as you expected in the finale. And so, yeah, the mother's pretty much there to, act as a form of subterfuge within inside the building to send everything collapsing. Although the rest of the family does a good job of bringing in the rest of the disaster as well. Soon everyone starts to finally, very shortly kind of meet up. Anna is unable to escape because there turns out to be a huge crowd of zombies and soldiers and chaos that just kept her from getting away. And Casper kind of jumps in to since he has the only gun amongst everyone too, so he becomes an important asset. And everything kind of escalates really quickly. I mean, I think we're about a third way into the film when everyone finally meets. It finally gets together, and soon we have separate events going on back to back. But beforehand, I think we should probably talk about the bunny, because I think everyone else is looking forward to talk about the bunny.
All right, Eric, the bunny, Nunu, or what is the name again?
Nunu.
Nunu. Nunu.
Nanu, Nanu. There's a bunny, and the girl likes it, and it runs away, and she goes looking for it, causing the rest of the family to panic.
Well, did the bunny run away?
No, it did not.
We actually did. Yeah, did we actually find out if the bunny actually really did run away or no?
Oh, Mike, are you implying that maybe
did we see the bunny again?
Mike, are you
the bunny?
Mike, are you implying that maybe they used it for food without her telling her? Because at this point, the rations are gone.
I thought they sent it out for help. I didn't even think of that, Phil.
Oh, wait, they did have that stew.
Yes.
Oh my God. Now it's all becoming clear to me. They didn't need you.
Oh, my God. And then she was looking for her bunny after that.
I told you this.
Oh my god!
They ate Ninu. What the fuck?
But even worse than that is if that's the case, because yeah, I mean now we're talking about the parents who will now begin to blame themselves for the girls' attempts to try to find the rabbit and what happens.
Right.
Never occurred to me.
Oh, God. Right, and yet the father still couldn't shoot the girl at the end. When she turned, he couldn't shoot her. He couldn't do it.
It didn't matter because he could have anyway, but...
Yeah, he didn't even...
That was a nice touch.
That was a nice touch, definitely.
Because he was going to kill himself instead of her.
Click. Oops.
Yeah. Although, I will say, I did read several reviews that were talking about... Mike, I agree with you when you were talking earlier about how those that kind of didn't get what they wanted out of Fear the Walking Dead would get it out of this. And I agree with that because I didn't stick with the Fear the Walking Dead. And this, something more like this, I think I would have stuck with. However, I just completely forgot what I was going to say now. Oh, well, go on. It'll come back. When it does, I'll bring it back. I'll bring it up again.
Well, in fairness, this is a movie that's 90 minutes, and that's a, what is it now, a 14-hour TV series? So I think if they took these 90 minutes and spread it out over two seasons, I don't think it would have been all that compelling, although most people aren't finding it all that compelling to begin with. But by the way, let's go back to the whole keeping secrets. Everything starts to fall apart in the real world because the government's keeping the secrets, as you said, or doesn't know anything. We know actually by this point, since they are rounding people up and shooting them, that by this point in the film, the government knows things and doesn't seem to be sharing it. And at the same time, the parents fuck everything up because they're keeping a secret from their daughter because they think that the truth is too horrible for her to handle.
Symbolism!
Well, you know, and the rabbits is probably is rabbits. We've talked about rabbits before, and it depends on the context that they're in. Strangely enough, all of the symbols that all of the things that rabbits represent that I'm familiar with or that I always think of, I really couldn't find a match for in this film. So if any of you have any brilliant ideas as to what the rabbit might symbolically mean, that would be really awesome. Because I really
love this thing.
Lunch.
I think you could argue that it represents, well, yeah, lunch in a way.
Well, put it this way. It's better to have the rabbit because if you have a guinea pig or a rat or a snake or something, it may not, you could see people saying, okay, the parents would eat a rabbit. Anybody would eat a rabbit, especially in Europe. But they're not necessarily going to eat a guinea pig in Europe or a rat in Europe or a snake in Europe. So I guess I'm thinking the director wanted an animal that could pass off as a food rather than just a pet. So it may not even have been – it could have been more for pragmatism rather than
– To make symbolism. Sense, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They want something
well, you
that –
you don't know, Stel.
They
you
want something
have
that
– burgers or something.
Yes. They want something that could be food and could be a pet, and that makes sense for a little girl. And yes, a little girl could have a boa constrictor as a pet, but going by cliche or by, you know, most familiar, a kitty, a bunny, a puppy, and people are going to be less likely to eat the bunny and the kitty, the puppy and the kitty.
Right. And that's part of it. So maybe I'm thinking there was no symbolism at all except, as Abe screamed out, lunch.
Although somebody was going to make a suggestion. Which one of you was it? Was it you, Mike?
About?
I don't know what the bunny might mean, but I agree. I think he was just there because it was the most convenient choice. But.
Because he does end up representing food, which they all become food eventually anyway. You know, bunnies represent a common food source, you know, where 98% of them are eaten before they're a year old. They're also rather prolific, right? You know, and you talk about how everything here is about relationships. So you have the whole fertility thing with bunnies.
The fertility thing, yep.
Yeah, but it's also that it's cute and fluffy, and you can certainly forecast the symbolism as the bunny is associated with the little girl and ends up becoming dinner. Little girl doesn't have a good future ahead of her.
Well, and if we did go with the whole fertility symbol, then, of course, them killing the rabbit is essentially dooming the entire human race. Because they're going to have to, you know, eat their for whatever. They're not going to be able to reproduce.
Kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit.
Abe, did you take a pill that you're just singing tonight? You should go on tour.
I've had a lot of coffee today.
I would like to disagree. Abe should not go on tour.
All right, so shall we get to the school? Shall we get to the...
Yeah, let's get to all that now, yeah.
Yeah, because I think the big thing here is that the son, who is distrustful of, as a teenager will be, distrustful of authority figures and has been, like, torn a hole in his tarp so he could spy, and he sees them dragging the father of his girlfriend out to be executed, we later figure out. So he sneaks out, follows the truck... and things have been going on long enough that I'm assuming this whole quarantine has become commonplace or a routine, I think is what I'm looking for, is routine for the soldiers. So they are not noticing the little things like the hole in the tarp that they should be able to see. And he follows the truck to a school where he sees them executing people, the zombies. He figures it out. He hears them. I don't think he sees it. And so he just decides that he's going to help those people, and he starts unlocking the trucks to let them out, and he never actually sees what's inside because he gets spotted and runs off. But we do hear the carnage starting to happen after him, and that's a very Walking Dead sort of moment, and a very typical, really zombie cliche sort of moment. But again, we see almost none of it. Actually, we see absolutely none of it, right?
Right. We just hear screaming and yelling and
the gunfire going off. And now, whether this is the event that sort of tips the balance into global chaos, or is just one of many similar unforeseen events that people fuck up that we've been watching in every zombie movie for the last 40 years, is completely besides the point. This is for at least the local event what completely upends everything. And sort of unofficially ends the quarantine.
Right, exactly. And therefore, everybody's out for themselves now at this point. Because there is no authority figure anymore, because that authority figure was pretty scary. Because if you didn't listen to what they said, they'd round you up or they just shoot you anyway. And now that that's gone... And now two things happen. One is everybody's out for themselves, as I said. But two, the zombies can now make it into the neighborhood. And whether it's they just get to the neighborhood because, you know, it's close to the school, or whether it's similar to some of these zombie films where the dead go back to what they know, you know, their old home or whatnot, we really don't know.
But it's also the case that the military is no longer taking zombies out. Right. So where before someone died and turned became a zombie, they would take them out and get rid of them to prevent further spread. Now, if anybody dies, they're going to turn, they're going to kill their family, and now you're going to get an exponential growth of the number of zombies in that quarantine zone.
Right.
It's all Gustav's fault.
That little fucker.
And yet he thought he was doing good.
Well, yeah, and you can make the same argument about the soldiers, you know, in black going around and keeping people in their homes and giving them food. You can make the same argument for the government that decided that it wasn't going to tell people that their loved ones were turning into monsters and were going to eat their faces off if they died in their homes. You know, good, and you can say the same thing about the parents who decided not to tell the little girl that they ate their bunny for dinner.
Right.
Does make me wonder if they all survived the film. When do you bring that up? Like, how old is the girl when
You probably
I don't think you ever bring it up.
Yeah, you never do. Yeah, you just don't. You just don't talk about it.
First rule of Rabbit Stew Club is don't talk about Rabbit Stew Club.
Yeah, well, see, I know my grandmother had a pet bunny that turned into dinner back during, I think, the Depression. But that was the Depression. It wasn't a zombie apocalypse.
That's tough.
Yeah.
Or tender.
Yeah.
Like bunny meat.
Well, I think we go to, is the next thing the little girl, disappearing?
Yeah, so the little girl, well, two things happen, right? One is Casper wants to go out to see what's going on, if there's a way to escape the city, or I should say the district or the town. And so he and Dino go out to do that. And the other thing is the little girl then sneaks out of the house looking for the rabbit, her pet rabbit, trying to find the pet rabbit, because she still doesn't understand that what's out there.
Well, do any of them really still?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. Not really.
Yeah, they still don't know it's a zombie apocalypse. That's right.
Yeah, but that's odd because there is that scene well before this when the glass gets broken because the guys reach into the house, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, but they don't know that the guy used to be dead. They just know it's a guy reaching through the window.
That's right.
Yeah, they're getting a point though that there are some sort of infected people, right? Because you can't be that brain dead, right? Because you're seeing multiple shots of the hands up against the window, of the people outside trying to get in the house, and nobody's talking.
They're also hearing a lot of gunfire. Hearing a lot of gunfire.
So they clearly know there's something up with the infected that's making them dangerous.
Yeah, and it's from this point on that the entire situation just escalates into an avalanche. We have several things happening at once, actually. We have several characters going out, Gustav and Mother looking for the little girl. We have Casper and Dino and one random woman they meet inside the school trying to escape from a horde of zombies. We have the mother turning and attacking Anna and Sonja. And it happens so quickly. It's not just what several events happen simultaneously. It's like one at a time. It's going back and forth between them. And the results are it happens so quickly. I mean, we first see Casper getting quickly killed off. Dino quickly shows himself to be not exactly the calmest person under pressure, where he actually steals the woman's supplies. Quickly showing himself to revert to be like the situation is like he's a man who's acting out of complete desperation. He's quickly learned to act to do something to protect his family, but he's not really thinking of others. It's kind of ironic because earlier he's willing to take in Sonja and the mother, you know, to let them stay safely, even though having them there would deplete their supplies quicker. But no sooner than like maybe a day or so later after this skirmish in the school, he quickly is quick to jeopardize someone else's survival and someone else's family's survival in order to protect his own.
Right, that's true.
Well, and that's part of how he transforms. Because in the beginning, he's this jokey dude who doesn't want to really take responsibility for his family, you know, and now he totally is. So that is his response to the crisis, is that eventually he becomes quote unquote the responsible person in terms of taking care of his family that he never was in the beginning.
Right.
That's what I got out of that.
Yeah, that's true. And about the attack of the little girl and the rabbit. So she gets bit. Do you think at that point they know she's going to turn into a zombie? Obviously Dino does, right? Because he says,
Yeah,
because he says we're gonna have to shoot her. Because suddenly, what happens is when they get back to the house after quote unquote saving the daughter, Sonya's mother, who was sick up in the bedroom.
Oh no, she was dead. She was straight up dead at that point.
Yeah, she died and became a zombie, and her daughter has to kill her, and then Anna somehow becomes a zombie. We never see how, possibly
through the air.
I think she got bit by Sanja's mother. We just don't see it happen.
Oh, that's a fair point. Yeah,
because she has a big tear on her neck. Basically, what happens is both Anna and Sanja are sitting in the room, and the mother revives as a zombie, and they hear her coming. We just don't see everything that happens. It was kind of jarring, but you kind of put two and two together.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Abe. So and that's how Dino is figuring it out, right? He sees people turning into zombies, and so now he knows his daughter is going to be a zombie, basically. And he wants to basically do the terrible thing of unfortunately killing your own daughter, even though
she's already dead.
Basically, you're absolutely right, Eric.
Well, and the question is whether he would he kill his daughter or not? He might do it to save his wife, but then he fucks that up. Right, you know, is that he doesn't kill her in time? The daughter kills the wife, and now
which just goes to back up my theory that children are horrible and ruin everything.
And that's supposed to be that's something.
I'm
Mike's
with you on
to,
that, Eric. I hear you there.
Eric, that's something Mike's supposed to say, not you. but Mike, let me ask you this: if the daughter's already infected and there's no help left, isn't she effectively, unfortunately, no matter how terrible it is, she's technically a dead walking dead anyway, right? So,
well, again, we know that.
Yeah, that's
they
true.
They suspect that.
Yeah, they suspect.
But people are still emotional, and you know, it kind of goes back to that film, Who Could Kill a Child? Which was
Mike could,
yeah, and yeah, absolutely. But I understand people who don't, and you always get a film where they cross the line. Whether it's and everyone has a different line, but people don't want to see violence against children. Some people it's violence against children, and they can't watch a film where no matter how much the evil little shit gets what he deserves, they can't handle watching somebody hit a child or kill a child. Same thing with women. Some people cannot watch a movie in which a man hits a woman, even if it doesn't matter who the woman is, what she did, how much of a danger she presents. That just makes them very uncomfortable. Then that's because there are real world connections to those images, and some people can disconnect from that and enjoy it for entertainment, and some people can't. There's too much empathy there. You know, and when you put this in the real world, there will be some people who couldn't pull the trigger on a child.
Right, right.
Especially if it's theirs.
Yeah. No, that's fair point.
I mean, you imagine whoever your loved ones are, and if they turned into – if they were in that situation where they were dying but not dead – and there was a chance in your mind that they were going to come back as an undead creature, would you kill them? And when would you do it?
Right.
And now imagine you haven't been watching horror films for, you know, the last couple of decades to mentally prepare yourself for these scenarios.
we always knew there's a good learning experience there somewhere. All right, so let's talk about the wrap up of the film, the climax. What happens to? Well, let me ask you this: the beginning of the film, the first 3 minutes of the film, is a fast forward, and then basically it's basically the last one of the last scenes of the film, and then they show it at the beginning of the film, and then they replay it near the end. Were you guys bummed that they did that when you look at it? I mean, I look back and I go, I wish they didn't have that scene at the beginning.
It didn't really matter. I kind of had an idea where it was all going anyway.
Same here.
All right. Fair enough.
I was okay with that. I just thought it provided a little bit of framing, because otherwise it just kind of starts with that opening scene of the lake, which, by the way, at the end it does pull out again and shows you the countryside with all the choirs. the fire's burning. What are you giggling about, Eric?
You said at the end.
You said a sexual innuendo.
I'm gonna pull out. Yeah.
Jesus.
Wait, yeah, Christy, you're gonna pull out? Is there something about you we should know?
All right, let's get back on track. All right, continue, Christy.
Oh, they pan back at the end and show you the woods and the countryside just as they do at the beginning. In the beginning, they're coming in. But at the end, you're seeing all of the fires burning so that you realize that although that Gustav and Sonya are running through the woods to what they hope is freedom, they're just going to be running into more trouble. And that everything has turned.
It's all fucked.
Yep.
Right. That's true. All right.
I was going to say I didn't mind that framing because otherwise the opening scene is just a shot of the lake. And it's not really – for this type of film, it's not really gripping. I think maybe that moment had to be established just so that we have a preview or an idea – going back to the relationship and how these characters change of where this movie is going. So, no, it did not bother me.
All right, that's fair. That's a fair point. Or a good way to look at it, actually. All right, so let's talk about the last thing. I mean, we're talking about it now, but any thoughts about it? The ending, Christy basically mentioned it, which is what happens is the zombies get into the house. Pernelia doesn't believe her daughter's going to turn. She gets bit but has her throat ripped out. So she's dead. Dino decides to shoot his daughter like he wanted to do in the first place because he knew that she was going to turn. And then he can't do it. So he decides to put the gun to his own head and he had run out of bullets, and so he gets ripped apart by zombies. And then we just see Sonya and Gustav heading into the forest towards Copenhagen or wherever. And we see that there's fires and smoke everywhere, and that's the film ends. Abe, your thoughts of the ending and how it turned out?
I kind of had an idea where it was going. I mean, it wasn't honestly all that kind of shocking. I mean, the zombie child is actually, I mean, he's been around since the Night of the Living Dead. I mean, that's one of the most iconic moments involving the child being infected. And I really expected it to end up any other way but complete tragedy. I mean, the entire situation just deteriorated so swiftly. That I just didn't think it was like, yeah, there's absolutely no way they can fight back. They have one gun out of the entire horde. It's the finale of a tragedy. It's the final act. It's everyone taking their final bow. I mean, the only slightest bit of silver lining in it is, you know, Sonya and Gustav running away, but it's, Chrissy says, like, they're not getting away into some safe zone. They're in the middle of the forest, and God knows how many other places have been hit by this disease. I mean, the ending was okay. I mean, it was appropriate for the film itself. I mean, it was completely in sync with its tone. So I thought it was all right.
All right. Mike, Chrissy, Abe, anybody?
Well, Abe just said it. Maybe call me a hopeless romantic, but I was actually surprised that they did go out on that bleak of an ending. And there were little things like should have been cluing me into the end when Dino leaves Casper to die.
Which I thought was a
really good intense scene, but it made sense because really, how many times in the movie have we seen the guy grab the gun and suddenly he's the hero and no, it's oh fuck and runs out. And truthfully, he probably wouldn't be able to shoot for shit anyway. He would have just gotten himself killed. So I appreciated that. And, yeah, so once the little girl gets bit by the old woman, then the warning flags are going up. But, yeah, the idea that all of them would end up going, the mother, the father, I guess you got the teens running, right? That's the final scene we see.
Right.
But yeah, it ended up, I was kind of surprised just how much of a downer it ended up being, and probably because I'm, you know, I've seen more upbeat zombie films of late, or zombie stories. Weirdly, I mean, not like happy-go-lucky things, but, you know, they've played more with the format and have experimented with other things. But even think like something like World War Z really kind of had a happy ending. You have films like Warm Bodies. You know, you could go through a lot of them. So the idea that all of them died really kind of, or almost all of them died, kind of shocked me. But I, for me, this is all about effectively shooting the scenes, setting it up, the tone, the atmosphere, putting in characters that, yeah, they're nobody's perfect, but they're all fairly identifiable and relatable. None of them is a massive prick that you're happy to see die, except maybe the little girl. So
Anna was no good too.
She was a little bitchy.
Anna was kind of a bitch, yeah.
But you know what? Fuck it. I understand that if you're stuck in a house with someone who has a, you know, the black plague, maybe you want to get the fuck out of there. I certainly identify with that. I don't know if I would do that put in that circumstance, but I can understand why she would. You know, so for me, this is all about execution, and I like the, and it's told in just just different enough for me that I could enjoy it, even, and it kept me a little bit guessing. So the ending for me, it worked. It worked. It hit home for me because I was kind of sorry to see all of them have this really bad end. And I have a feeling, unless there's a sequel, that what's his face? Gustav and Sonya are not long for this world either.
Right. Yep. No, that's a fair point. That's how I've kind of gathered it too. Eric, what about yourself?
This movie was well made, well executed, but held absolutely no surprises for me whatsoever. If you're into the zombie movie thing, this is another one. So check it out. If you're not, then you can move on.
Yeah, I liked it too. I liked it, period. It's a pretty thrilling film. Like everybody said, you know, I mean, it's a zombie film. How more can you be original? Can it be? But I think it was executed, as Mike said, well enough and differently that it still makes it stand out. Whether it's a classic, you know, it's a zombie film. There's thousands of them, but it's one of the better ones I've seen, and I could see it, you know, making, you know, a top 20 list at the end of the year. It could be the best zombie film of the year. But I would recommend it. The bleakness was surprising, like Mike said, but it does make sense too, to be honest. So, what about you, Chrissy? Your opinions, final thoughts and such.
I enjoyed this film. I think that if you like movies that are dark dramas about families faced with crisis, if you like movies about that make comments about relationships, you will enjoy this. If you're a diehard zombie fan, you will probably enjoy this, but don't expect a lot of gore. This film really more plays on the creepy. It plays on what you don't see rather than what you do. Also, the other thing I liked about this movie a lot was that I remembered what I was going to say. I'd seen in reviews that there was a lot of comparisons made to The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead. But I tended to disagree a little bit only because, you know, the characters we see in The Walking Dead as well as Fear of the Walking Dead, they're very comic booky. They're very badass. They're very like what you guys were just talking about where, you know, he leaves his friend to die. That's really more of what a normal person would do. And the characters in this movie are just completely believable. They don't have that little comic book superlativity edge to them. So those are my final thoughts. It's not something I'm going to own, but I did enjoy it. And I would recommend it definitely if you're a zombie fan or if you like a good, intense, dark drama, then this is for you.
All right, very well. So I think everybody spoke. Mike, have you given your last thoughts?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, all right.
I would just say I understand perfectly where Abe and Eric are coming from. I don't get sick of the zombie films, but people who are, I get it. This is as a fan, it's a variation on a theme, and I can enjoy the variation. Even though it's not a substantial one, it's just executed well. But if you're tired of it, you're tired of it.
Yeah. As for me, as you know, I mean, it doesn't provide anything new to the genre. That said, it's not a bad film. It's just not a film that might not end up being the most memorable amongst the great sea of zombie media. I mean, whether it's a game or movie or book or whatever, I mean, there's just so much there that it's going to be hard. Maybe hard for it to stand out. But if people enjoy this genre enough, I'm sure there'll be something in there they'll like. I just thought the movie's quality is not a problem. It's, you know, in terms of his acting or his presentation, it's just that it doesn't have anything that will immortalize it in amongst his competition. But you know, it doesn't mean I don't think people should go at least get a shot if they want to. But as Christian said, if you're looking for a lot of zombie action, a lot of badass moments, you're not going to find that there. It's a very low key, very slow, gradual build up of a film with a pretty good payoff. And it definitely feels like more of a drama with a backdrop of monsters, which is what zombies usually play in these kinds of stories. They're the backdrop for the human drama. But this is a special case where they're mostly that. They're not, you know, they're mostly on screen for the most part. I mean, we're just seeing the deterioration of a family and the people around them. But, as I said, you know, if you want to, it's still worth checking out. You can rent it on Amazon Video. That's only one of the few places that I know of that is where it's available. I'm not sure if it's on DVD yet, but if you can find it, go check it out.
Yeah, it's also iTunes as well. Both are $6.99.
Right, so. It's not on all streaming services. It's not on Vudu, so. I don't know if it's on other ultraviolet services, so you're going to have to do at least one of those other two. I don't know what our listeners' preferred services, but whatever it is, give it a shot. But you can at least find it through one of them.
Yep, that's right. So, all right, very good. So that's What We Become, as Christy said, it has numerous meanings. As Mike said, it even has even more than meanings than Christy thought. So it's a cool title, I must say, too. What We Become.
It is a good title for a zombie movie, absolutely.
Yeah, it sure is. So, all right.
And I think between this and last week's film, which was
They Look Like People.
Yep. I think we've got a good little streak here of going of movies with awesome titles, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point, Mike. So, all right. So, What We Become, Danish film, 2016 release, both in Denmark and the U.S. of A. If you love zombies, this is a film that you'll probably like. If you love infection films, this is a film that you will probably like. If you like doomsday films, this is a film that you probably like. So, that will pretty much determine whether or not this is a film for you. Before we lead out, I did have one other question for Eric. Speaking of zombie films, one that was kind of slow but well received 2 years ago, the ones about the baseball players. Mike, what was the name of that one called again?
Oh, The Battery.
The Battery. Yeah, Eric, what was your opinion of that film? Since that's a zombie film too, and I'm curious.
I think I might have liked that one a little better than this one. I don't want people to get the wrong idea. I didn't dislike What We Become. It was just not something I needed to watch, if that makes any sense. and I enjoyed the relationship between the two guys in The Battery more than the family relationship in What We Become.
See, the battery I would still like to see. I haven't seen that yet.
Just because I thought it was simpler to keep track of the relationship between two people than the relationships between a dozen. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yep. What about that Australian zombie film from last year, Eric? What the heck was it? I forget what it was called. Mike, you remember the one where...
Zombie?
Yeah, it was kind of...
Wormwood?
Yeah, Wormwood.
Oh, that was cheesy. I didn't care for that one myself. I mean, it was fun. You know, it was fun in an Evil Dead kind of way. But I didn't even like... It doesn't come to mind when I think of zombie movies because it was so over the top.
Right.
Yeah, all right. So Eric is, we can see, you know, he's still willing to give a zombie film a chance, but he's a tough sell.
But he did like Dead Snow 2.
He did.
Yes. I absolutely love Dead Snow 2.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like I hate all zombie movies. It's just like the ones that are a repeat of what's been done before, they lose my interest pretty quickly because I've seen it before. That's all.
Yeah. All right. Very well. All right. So, there's numerous perspectives of the new film from us to you, the listeners, What We Become. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen us talk about What We Become. Come back next week and we'll see what we became.
Maybe The Conjuring 2?
Maybe.